All right. Thank you, Rob Martyr. How are you, Rob? How was the time off, buddy?
Oh, man. A couple of days, I went up to Montreal to watch my boys graduate from high school.
Congratulations, man.
The twins, Charles and Oliver, are high school graduates. I couldn't have been more proud.
Oh, that's amazing. Congrats,
man. Thank
you. That's awesome.
Thank you. They did well.
Montreal, do you miss it? I mean...
you know what? I do because I had a great time while I was up there. But I, you know, look, I mean, Chicago's my hometown. I grew up here. So, but yeah, no, it was great to be back. The weather cooperated. The church was a little hot and stuffy. You know, the graduation lasted about 2 hours. And, you know, Martyr boys are in the M, so they're kind of near the back. And, you know, I was getting a little itchy there toward the end. But no, it was fun.
Well, we missed you here. Good to have
you
back.
Thanks, man.
Buddy.
It's good to be back. Thank you.
All right. It's a download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman with you till 11 o'clock tonight. Got a great show lined up. I'm so excited to be back on the air this week. Monday, it's always a fresh night, right? Kind of joking with Ro a little bit about the idea of saying, how was your weekend? But the truth is, everyone's already done with the weekend. It's 7 o'clock on Monday night, right? So from here on out, it's going to be, how was your Monday? It was a good weekend for me. Father's Day was a hit. It was strong. Went to the History Museum. Learned all about the Pritzker family tree. Really strong. Real strong. That's the first thing you when you go into the Chicago History Museum, because the Pritzkers gave money, the first thing you get is the Pritzker family tree. All right. Well, that's great. It'd be great if it was interactive, like you could switch the names or try other people. But, yeah, okay, yeah, they're big family in Chicago. They're rich. Get it. I get it. Their tree's more important than mine. Understood. It's so weird. Oh, we got a great show lined up tonight. I'm so excited. Coming up, speaking of Montreal, coming up in the 8 o'clock hour tonight at the big table, sitting down with me, Hall of Fame. It's not our first Hall of Famer. We've had some football Hall of Famers up in here. But I want to say it's our first baseball Hall of Famer. No? Who else we got?
Big Hurt.
Oh, yeah. What am I talking about? That's right. The Hurt was on. So, anyway, our first Montreal Expo Hall of Famer. How about that? Tim Raines. Tim Rock Raines is going to be on the show at 8 o'clock tonight. He's my guest at the big table. He's written the book Rock Solid, My Life in Baseball's Fast Lane, where he talks about what he did on the diamond to change the game and what he did off it that almost took the game from him. Of course, people remember Tim Raines as having a battle, a public battle with drugs. So we'll talk with him about his life, both on the diamond and off. It's coming up at 8 o'clock at the big table. How fun is that? Tim Rock Raines. God, I love that guy. Hated him as a Cubs fan, right? Because he hit, it's amazing reading the book. He hit something like 330 all the time. Just 330. Imagine a leadoff hitter today that, I mean, it's kind of interesting to see what's happening with Rizzo and others, like sort of changing the way that the leadoff hitter is used. Tim Raines at his time, back in the early 80s, changed the game. The way that he played it, and guys like Ricky Henderson and others who came up at that time, Vince Coleman, you think about, they changed the game. They made it a small ball kind of game. Tim Raines, my guest, coming up in the 8 o'clock hour. Of course, 7:30 tonight. It's Monday night, so that means it's Touche night. Chris and Dave will be here. We'll talk about who's hiding what, when, where, and why. Some unprecedented political maneuvers in the Senate over the health care bill. We'll talk with Dave and Chris about what they think about the new way we do business in Washington. That's coming up 7:30 tonight. Once the 9 o'clock hour, Liz Dozier is going to be back. Liz Dozier, the former principal at Fenger High School, who was a star of the CNN series Chicagoland, is now over at Chicago Beyond, and she's getting headlines for her Go Innovate campaign, the second year of this, where they're trying to raise $2 million, and she's partnered up with Chance the Rapper, try and get innovative ideas so that they can fund them. Essentially, if you give them a good idea in a 90-second video, they're willing to fund you if it has to do with youth safety and education. We'll talk with Liz Dozier about her work over at Chicago Beyond. And also tonight, I'm excited about this, from the Food Network, one of the co-stars of The Kitchen, Chef Marcela Valladolid. How about that, huh? She will be in studio tonight in the 9 o'clock hour. Marcela Valladolid. That's it. Anyway, she's the star of The Kitchen. She's got a new book called Casa Marcela, Recipes and Food Stories of My Life in the Californias. So we'll be talking with her in the 9 o'clock hour. And then Studio 435, Mooner. Lee Ketch is back. Mooner was one of the first bands we ever had in Studio 435. And he is back in studio tonight. He's playing, and the band Mooner is playing at the Hideout this weekend. So we'll get some live music tonight in the 10 o'clock hour. News, weather, and traffic with Rob Martyr. Production provided by Pete Zimmerman, and I am Justin Kaufman. This is The Download, a show about Chicago starring those who know it well. All right, we'll take a break. We'll come back. We'll do the carryout. Stay with us. 630 called out that I forgot Esmeralda in the intro. I said, news with Rob Martier, production by Pete Zimmerman. They're right. Esmeralda's here tonight. Yeah, I just slipped it. I'm sorry. I apologize. Esmeralda Leon will be on traffic starting 10 o'clock. There you go. Got it been there. All right, let's do the carryout. All right, here are today's top stories. A special session has been called, and Illinois lawmakers will be back down in Springfield starting Wednesday. So what's it mean? Well, in this weird world of state politics, it means start up the attack ads. And not the folksy kinds either. No, dial up the black and white and frayed Mike Madigan is the devil imagery. Because that's what you do the week you try to compromise and hammer out a deal, right? Republicans say they have a plan and they want the majority party to pass it. Problem is, they're not the majority party. They're not even close. So don't they need compromise? No, silly me. This isn't about a budget. This is about an election in 18 months. Someone has to be on the hook for having the worst state government in the union. Because right now, Rauner's running as if he's not been governor for the past 4 years. And the Democrats are running as if they have not been the majority control in the legislature. In other words, imagine if you not only didn't do your job, but then pretended like you didn't have a job in the first place. Spooky. IDOT has threatened to halt all construction if no budget is in place by the 30th, and the Trib reported today that they're already slowing down the projects. If that's not enough to get you to the polls next election, nothing is. Sorry, but you didn't get a budget. You didn't get a budget done. Because of politics. And now I have to merge left? No. Can we vote now? Like absentee, like 18 months in advance? I want to vote now. Every time I see a sign with an arrow blinking saying merge, I want to vote. Right now. In D.C., it's getting weird in the Senate where Republicans are working on a new less mean health care bill. But the problem is they're doing it in secrecy. They won't let anyone see it, not even Democrats. Then the goal will be to submit it at the last minute and then vote on it by using reconciliation to avoid filibuster or, you know, reading it. I don't know. I guess I get the idea that there really is no bipartisan anything anymore. But one party has, I mean, this party has a 2-vote majority, and that's enough for them to throw out 250 years of civics. At least fake it, right? Like the Democrats do. They do public hearings and pretend they're listening, and then they ram it down your throats. You know, the American way. This, though? I don't know. Seems very Eastern Bloc. Ooh. Some congressmen are pushing for lawmakers to be able to carry guns after last week's shootings in Virginia. It's interesting because Neil Steinberg in the Sun-Times today talked about that congressional shooting wasn't even the biggest shooting of the day. And in terms of mass shooting, it pales in comparison. Just look at the weekend numbers in Chicago to see how prevailing violence has been in our culture. It's worth a read. But before we let congressmen strap up to the Capitol building, read Neil Steinberg. There you go. The U.S. Supreme Court said that it was unconstitutional to ban disparaging or disrespectful trademarks. They say that you have the right to create douchey trademarks, and it's protected by free speech. This would have repercussions for the Washington Redskins, as people would file suit against that name. So the Supreme Court has spoken. You can continue to use an offensive term to represent your football team.
Yay. Go team. Yay.
A new study says that the social media giant Facebook is addictive. Yep. How about it? Just like drugs or alcohol. The social media giant is somehow messing with our brains and we are getting addicted. I'm sorry. What were we talking about? Someone just liked one of my posts and I just completely lost where we're at. And it just distracted me. I mean, they like me. They really, really like me. God. Love Facebook. In weather, it's cooled off considerably. Hey, I don't mind a cool summer breeze, but you know what? Is it bad that I'm already nostalgic for a 90-degree heat? Like, stop playing with my emotions here. In sports, the rumors are heating up this week that it could be the last for Jimmy Butler in a Bulls uniform. The Celtics traded their top pick away to move down in a draft and pick up a couple more draft picks. They've been doing this, sort of, so they could put a move together to package for a superstar. And all signs point to a certain superstar here in Chicago. And I'm not talking Nikolai Mirotic. Now, tonight, ESPN's reporting that the Cavaliers are making a move for Jimmy Butler. Aha! They want to add Butler to the mix to try and back get back to the finals next year. Wow. Well, will the Bulls pull the trigger and go full rebuild, or will the Bulls stay the course and pick up a bunch of old free agents to create a late 90s Houston Rockets? Great story. Out in the second round of the playoffs, though, right? But in basketball, that's pretty much what you're going to have to do for the next couple of years. So do you just skip the playoffs and wait till Steph Curry gets old or breaks a leg? Or do you stack up a bunch of has-been all-stars that want to own their own Kia dealerships? You know, you got to – which is fine. I like Kia, you know. I'm also annoyed that everybody just thinks they can have Jimmy Butler, right? I mean, he's our superstar. It seems disrespectful that all the contending teams are using us as their farm system, right? I think that's telling. Might be telling where they think the Chicago Bulls are right now. In baseball, both clubs had a successful weekend. The Cubs were on the road, beat up on the Pirates, winning 2 of 3, but not without some injuries. So get this. Cubs are testing the depth chart. Zobrist is on the DL, possibly for a long stint. And now Hayward is hurt. Addison Russell's ailing. So that means Baez, Happ, Almora. Your time's now. No more of this. If they can do a little more seasoning. No, you got to do it now. The good news, Rizzo's just been great as a leadoff hitter. I mean, over the weekend, he hit another homer in the leadoff spot. They got the Padres tonight, which they're already losing, and then the Marlins later this week. Got to take care of biz, right? Nothing better than an ailing squad than the Padres and the Marlins. Ugh. The Sox, after taking 3 of 4 from the Orioles, went and took 2 of 3 from the Blue Jays. Not a bad week, although they're still 5.5 back. Sitting in the cellar in the old AL Central, James Shields returned yesterday, didn't pitch terrible. Carlos Rodon should be back up in the rotation soon. You know how I know this? I watched a live Charlotte Knights game on Saturday night on Comcast 2. Not even Comcast 1, it was Comcast 2. The Indianapolis Indians and the Charlotte Knights. I just like, I totally got sucked into the hype. Oh, yeah, the Charlotte Knights are going to watch this. I was like, what am I doing? I mean, you really kind of hit rock bottom if it's Saturday night and you're watching minor league baseball on Comcast too. But they look good. The youngsters look good. Oh, the Sox are going to get a big test tomorrow. They got Minnesota in Minnesota for a 3-game set. With all the heat on the old NBA draft this week, not much attention being paid to the NHL draft, which will be this weekend at the United Center. Will the Hawks be players and trading away assets to get better draft picks, or do they stay put at some point? They'll have to deal with their salary cap. But is this the year? I mean, they were the number one seed. They just got unlucky, bounced in the first round. Do they believe they have what it takes? Who are we kidding? They do. Right? And they're a great team. It is interesting that the expansion draft is on Wednesday. Marcus Kruger left available. So could be the end of him in Chicago. All right. Finally tonight, scientists in Australia were busy exploring the famed Eastern Abyss, the deep part of the ocean there. They discovered a bunch of new types of fish. All shaped like, well, that part of a male anatomy. Hey, it's nature. And you know, like in 20 years, the Michelin-starred restaurants on Michigan Avenue are going to be all about it. Yes, I'll have the miso-crusted Chilean dongfish. Does that come with mashed potatoes? That's the carryout for June 19th, 2017. Hey, we've got tartar sauce packets if you need some sauce for your dongfish. It's totally what it's going to be. It's going to be 10 years, and we'll be like, such a delicacy. All right, coming up, Touche. Chris Roebling, Dave Lundy in studio to argue about, well, everything. That's coming up, 720 WGN. Stay with us. All right, Rob Martyr.
First of all, happy belated Father's Day to all the dads out there.
Oh, I thought it was just to me.
To you as well. Yeah, all the dads out there. It's you know, sometimes it's a thankless job, but a very important one, so we do it willingly.
That's right.
You know, far be it from me, Justin, to take a shot at other media outlets, but in this case it's CNN, so I'll go ahead and do it.
Yeah, that's fine.
They had the breaking news splashed across the bottom of the screen. The breaking news was Sean Spicer out as White House press secretary.
Right.
Except it was with a question mark. It wasn't. They weren't exclaiming.
So
they weren't
speculation. Right.
Yeah. Like how was that? How was a question breaking news?
And it's also not breaking news because that story's been out all day.
Correct. Yes.
Yeah, I have a feeling that in our society, we will look back in the history books, will look back and say, remember that phrase breaking news and how CNN changed it? It doesn't mean what it used to mean. That's what's going to happen.
Now, Sky News did something interesting. They don't do breaking news. What they do is kind of a live, and the thing sweeps up across the screen,
okay,
which was kind of cool. So it was like live. Whoosh.
Yeah, I'm okay with some shoo. You know, that's okay.
Yeah.
I think if they could translate some of the scrolls into sound effects.
Right.
I would be much more intrigued. I would watch. Then I'd be like, ooh, what do we got? Then I'm like, it could be breaking, could be developing. It could be just in.
I better pay attention. The swooshing
right, exactly.
Sound effect is
the
out.
The swoosh just grabbed my attention. There you go.
There we go.
I just said that.
I know you just said that.
Okay, I'm not sure where you're going with this.
Well, I'm not sure where you're going with this.
That's what I just said.
That's what I'm saying to you.
All right.
Yeah, in studio tonight, Dave Lundy, Chris Roebling, ready to.
Those awards over there.
These are the Silver Dome Awards. We put them up so everyone could see. Yeah, WGN swept.
It did really?
Nice. This is the
the big award.
Yeah, Chicago Market Radio Station of the Year.
Folks,
oh, excellent.
If you are watching this
because of 7:30 on Monday nights, right?
It is. It was a touche. They just didn't have enough room on the trophy to put touche.
That was the next line of copy. Next,
yeah, right. They just took it off. Of course, every Monday night here, 7:30, Chris and Dave tussle over the issues in the news. Let's talk. Let's get right into healthcare. The big issue today. Let's go right to the Senate. The Senate, it looks, I mean, it's a foregone conclusion that they've taken the House bill that passed and everyone went to the Rose Garden with the Bud Light and the Coors Light, whatever it was, and they've thrown that in the trash in the way that now we're hearing that they're behind closed doors and they're coming up with their own thing.
What? Justin, 13 Republican male senators, 13 Republican male senators got together and they wrote a bill in secret. And they don't want to let anybody see it, and they don't want to have any committee hearings on it, and they don't want to allow any amendments on it. They're literally taking a bill that's life and death issues, and take it straight to the floor with no vetting, no opportunity for anybody to really poke the holes in this thing and figure out what's going around. And what's amazing about this is every single Republican who complained about the Obamacare process, where they had 100 hearings and hundreds of amendments, including hundreds of Republican amendments that were adopted. Those very same people, Mitch McConnell, I'm looking at you, Paul Ryan, I'm looking at you. Those same people are sitting there going like, no, we're going to do this all in secret. And see how that process works.
They're not doing it all in secret.
They're doing 100% in secret. Nobody has seen this bill. Republican senators are complaining they can't see the bill.
No one ever saw any of the bills that took the name Obamacare, okay, before they were themselves introduced.
All of those
bills, you are taking a natural element of the legislative process and misrepresenting it to busy taxpayers.
Why are they doing that? Why? I mean, you're talking about article after article, and even senators talking about why are they talking?
What you are looking at here is one of the most complicated, right? And I believe, notwithstanding what David says, notwithstanding what the folks who are supporting the dead carcass of Obamacare, okay, where coverage is down, prices are up, exchanges are empty,
because the Trump administration is trying to kill what's left of the ACA.
This is all happening under Obama, and so. You've got people trying to get to a start of the conversation to repeal and replace major chunks of this thing. And they have to make sure that their ideas cohere with each other before they go out into the public and have guys like David say, well, this is an incoherent mass of bad, poorly thought out ideas.
Yeah, but Chris, they're not doing what you just described.
That's exactly what they're doing.
They're taking the bill straight to the floor. This has never been done in the history of the country on an issue of this kind. It's never happened before.
The great thing about the Senate is it's counter-majoritarian, And you are going to have, the Democrats are going to have any number of opportunities for procedural and other roadblocks if they really want to exercise.
But no opportunities for to amend the bill or actually have hearings where you can bring in experts who can talk about what the bill means.
Well,
How do you get in here and defend the indefensible?
I'm not
week after week after week.
What's indefensible is the fact that you guys came up with a bill that is already, came up with a program which has already crashed and burned and broken promises with basically every individual out there who was supposed to participate in what you considered to be, you know, enormous care at no cost to anybody. You were
nobody
wrong on
that.
Both sides
no,
of
it. No, nobody said that. And by the way, the CBO, which you guys love to attack, said that, there would probably be about 20 million people who would get coverage under Obamacare. And guess what? There were 20 million people who got coverage under Obamacare. And now the CBO is saying 23 million people are going to die or are going to be sent off health care in the AHGA.
I love the arguments. Well, I love the touche. But you know, we're not arguing about whether or not Obamacare worked or not. We're already past the point where Republicans have said that they are replacing it. The House passed a bill out.
We've been saying that for six, eight years.
But you never had a plan.
It wasn't like yesterday.
But the question here on the table today is about the secrecy, the lack of transparency, the idea that it's behind closed doors. You know, and like Dave said, and I've read it as well in places like Politico and other places that say this is unprecedented. This is the first time in history that government's been done this way.
You know, it's the first time in history that so vast and unfunded entitlement program has been so deeply reformed so early in its life. And if we've learned anything about healthcare legislation, it is the overwhelming complexity of the thing. And if senators have got to take some time to make sure that they are coming up with whatever it is, I'm sure it's going to be hundreds of pages, if not possibly thousands of pages. If they want to make sure that their plan being written as we speak is actually going to be a coherent renunciation we deserve that.
Dave,
we ought to celebrate that
patience?
Compared to what you guys did.
Is the Republicans' plan right now of secrecy behind closed doors, is it about patience and getting it right?
Obamacare was an 18-month production, literally 100 hearings. Chris, I would agree with you. I would have absolutely no problem if the Republicans wanted to sit down and craft their legislation before they introduced it, unlike that piece of garbage known as the AHCA that has a 17% approval rating. I would have no problem with that if the process, as you just said, the process was followed and we then went to hearings and we brought in experts who actually looked at this and said, hey, this isn't going to work because you're going to wind up throwing these people off health care.
You know, I read this in The Hill today. Newt Gingrich had an opinion piece, which was very, really interesting about comparing what's happened to May in the UK to Trump in the United States, essentially about what he calls an age tax. That the idea that in the AHCA that we saw, the bill that came out of the House, that there was a strange way that the flow of marketing or the way that we talked about the idea that if you got older, you were going to pay more than you were. And it amounts to the idea of this, quote, age tax. And it was the same concept with nursing homes that was happening in Britain. And it was one of the reasons why they lost confidence in that government. The question I have for you is, and this is what he says, what's the rush? Why are Republicans rushing to the floor to get this done? Why not slow down and get it right or make sure that you can market this in a way that the approval ratings and the old way of saying this is the 53% of the country wants this? Let's do this.
In other words, didn't you learn anything from the ACA process?
Well, there is a decided majority of, I believe, not just Republicans, but Americans who know that Obamacare has failed.
Gingrich mentioned that, yeah. Okay.
There's 55% approval rate.
There is no question.
You have, Republicans right now have the floor.
And I myself, you know, Mitch McConnell doesn't call me and ask me how should I be doing this stuff, and nor does Donald Trump. So I'm not, but my preference is to, you know, I wonder why there weren't hearings seriously last November, last December about people who received promises from Obamacare that were never delivered upon. Okay, and that should have been a drumbeat that built and built from January to February to March to April, and it should have identified specific areas of failure within the Obamacare structure so that then the senators can stand up and say, well, we've had these hearings that David's talking mm-hmm. about. We've had these hearings. We've heard right. this testimony. We know it failed here. And here's what we're going to do instead of that. And then you have.
But you couldn't do that because if you did that, it would have exposed the fact that the GOP has been systematically sabotaging this bill from the very beginning, including defunding the risk corridors that resulted in the premium increases we see today. And we know this for a fact because Alaska looked at that problem. They were facing 50% or greater premium increases. And they said, you know what, if we just supplement. The insurance companies and subsidize them and to protect them in case they have big losses. Let's see what happens. And what happened? The insurance companies came back and instead of 50% increase, they had 7% increase. It was an 85% cut. This can be done.
No,
you guys have
no,
been sabotaging
it cannot, no,
this.
No. Look, we're not sabotaging this. What has sabotaged Obamacare in general, overall, is supply and demand. And what Obamacare did was open the gates of supply. And there are a lot of people, you know, and we all want health care and we all think everybody should have health care. And I mean, we're not trying to deny people access to health care. But when you have a system that is prepared to do so much health care, then you open it up to three or four times that, you are going to get more demand than you have supply. And that is exact. Now, David pulls out the risk corridor idea. And let me just say that that is like a molehill next to the Mount Everest of over demand, which is good demand. It's not bad demand. We want people
demand,
to have
demand, otherwise known as health care.
But you have to have, you've got to have a mechanism to deliver.
Let me do this.
To serve that demand.
Let's take a break. Touche. It's getting hot in here. We should play that Nelly song. Chris Roebling, Dave Lundy, we'll take a break. We'll come back. We'll move on from healthcare and we'll talk about the Georgia Six and also who's under what investigation. We can talk about that as
not
well.
Not me. Well,
touche. Stay with us.
I just said that.
I know you just said that.
Okay, I'm not sure where you're going with this.
Well, I'm not sure where you're going with this.
That's what I just said.
That's what I'm saying to you.
All right.
Touche.
Touche. Time for rapid fire touche. The second half here. Chris Roebling, Dave Lundy in studio. Is Trump under investigation or is he not? Dave Lundy.
I believe my president when he tweeted out, I am under investigation.
That's
and
so
it was
unclear,
the most.
Though. That is so ambiguous. I don't know why you act like that's an easy chair of simple meaning.
I am under investigation where I have to tell you, the hardest job for a communications person or somebody in America is defending Donald Trump.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you very much. I
so go ahead, Chris. Show us how it's done.
Well, I mean,
and in mid sentence, the president will tweet something.
Does it matter? I mean, is this all just a word game by Democrats and what happened? Does it matter?
Well, let's observe the obvious. Sekulow got ahead of his skis and made himself look, you know, silly.
Lawyer, yeah.
Because he's a very bright guy. He's a very accomplished lawyer, and worked with him on a number of occasions. And I don't know he got out there with two different ideas of what he was going to say. That doesn't help. Is the president under investigation? Who the heck knows? I mean, the only person who knows is Robert Mueller and his team, and maybe or maybe not some of the president's attorneys. Because when Sekulow starts talking about federal criminal practice and we haven't gotten a target letter, that's 78 yards down the field from where they would appear to be at this moment. Mm-hmm. Because right now you've got this sense that Mueller is following up on Comey testimony, hopefully about Loretta Lynch saying don't call it an investigation, call it a matter, and about Trump saying I hope Flynn gets out of this thing alive or whatever the heck he said, and so it would seem that the Trump statement, the Lynch statement, these are being looked at formally, and so that would mean that their statements are under investigation.
Look, the reality is that the Republicans keep putting a straw man out there, which is to say Donald Trump colluded with Russians and he never did.
No,
that was never the Democratic straw man. That was Democrats never put that out there.
Colluded with
the campaign did. But the response of the Republicans. Notice the difference between what the two of us just said. The straw man is that Donald Trump colluded. I never said that. I said the campaign colluded with the
Russians. You don't have evidence for either.
Actually, I have lots of evidence.
You have no evidence.
I have lots of evidence of lying by the Republicans, by the Trump associates, when it comes to Russia. And you know I have lots of evidence.
You don't have any evidence of collusion.
Say, I didn't have a meeting.
There is no evidence of
collusion. Let Mueller do his job.
Well, I mean, that's a foregone conclusion. I mean,
well, it's not a foregone conclusion. Donald Trump's been tweeting shots at Mueller and shots at Rosenstein. He's clearly laying the groundwork. Fox News is clearly laying the groundwork to fire Mueller and fire Rosenstein.
I don't think that I don't think the president has taken a shot at Mueller yet in the
tweets. Yes, he has.
But I think that he has taken shots at Rosenstein. And you know what? Mueller has not done himself any great favors when he's got people on there. He's hired people who have made many, many political contributions and only to Democrats.
Which he's not even allowed to look at in evaluating his staff.
You know, he needs to be sensitive to appearances. And when you're talking about appearance of conflict of interest, that's a very good one. And number two, we're not supposed to have leaks out of that operation. And there is some splaining to do about where these leaks have come from. And what I think Democrats, first of all, I deny what Dave just said about Republicans. But I will say, here is something Republicans say. The leaks are obvious crimes and they have to be investigated and they've got to be prosecuted. They've got to find out who has been breaking the rules, whether it was Susan Rice or some person working for Mueller or somebody else. Those people who have broken the rules need to be held to account.
I'm just wondering, 6 months from now, are you still going to be blaming Hillary Clinton and Susan Rice and Loretta Lynch for what's been happening under this administration?
Since you don't have a predicate act, since you don't have a crime to point to, I'm talking about actual crimes, and you deride that, and you're an officer of the bar, of the court.
Yeah, but isn't it the same,
You have an obligation to follow up on this stuff.
Well, isn't the same?
Because it's inconvenient for you politically, ignore your duty.
I'm an inactive officer of the bar, so I have no legal obligation. But nonetheless,
right. You don't care.
Let's move on.
Okay.
Tomorrow, a big runoff election in Georgia, the Georgia 6.
Oh.
This is one we've been paying attention to. A referendum, if you will, on the Trump administration, Trump politics, the Republicans, a Republican district that has a surprise Democrat that might actually push if the polls are correct.
Yeah, I mean, look, if the Democrats have any hope of retaking the House in 2018, they have to win districts like this one in Georgia. This is a Republican district. Donald Trump won it by 1 point, but the previous congressman, Tom Price, now the Secretary of HHS, won it by 21 points. So it's a Republican district, but we have to win that. See, on this show previously, Chris has always wanted to say, oh, you guys said you were going to win Montana. No, never said that. You guys said you were going to win Kansas. No, nobody said that. This one, Democrats actually have to win.
Okay,
and if we come back here next week,
I'm going to say David is wrong about that too. Look,
why we don't have to win it?
Okay. In the terms that you just
so if we lose, I'll come back next week and I'll go, hey, you can't rub it in my face because you said
right
I didn't
ahead.
Have to win.
You go right ahead. I mean, look, but the thing is, the Democrats have spent a fortune on the Georgia race, and much more so than the Republicans,
yeah.
And they're going to look pretty foolish if they can't pull it off. My sense is they won't pull it off, but I disagree with David. The problem that the Republicans face is not whether or not the Democrats can win in Tom Price's district right now. The problem that they face is whether or not there will be discernible signs of economic progress for the regular people out there in the country who are going to turn out and vote in November of 2018. If there are signs of economic progress, despite all of this stuff, you know, this crazy investigation, blah, 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 all of that stuff is going to go by the board and the House will remain Republican. If the economy is mired in sort of just 200,000 new jobs a month, if we're not really making any tracks, then I think people will hold the Republicans and Trump to account. And then Democrats will have a shot at taking the House.
Now, the question, which is the big question here, is how much will Democrats let Republicans change the rules of the economy to make it slick? Meaning we saw the financial rules and regulations sort of pulled away from Wall Street.
Wait, what are you talking about?
Sadly, Democrats have very little to say about this.
What are you talking about?
Talking about the regulations, the finance regulations, the banking regulations.
Dodd-Frank?
Yeah.
Look,
yeah.
we had I mean, we once had tremendous community banks in this country. And those were banks that were capitalized between $5 billion, $15 billion, maybe up to $18 billion. And they were close to a physical community.
Yeah, Dubuque, I know.
And those things have been, wait a minute, Justin, this is a reality. You have people in Dubuque, Iowa, or you have people in Rockford, Illinois, Joliet. You've got people even in the suburbs of Chicago. Because of Dodd-Frank, they're now talking to people who represent vast corporations that have no particular interest in their economy.
I have
an
answer.
And that is the opposite of the way this economy should be run.
The answer to your question is Republicans will get everything that they most everything that they want, certainly on the regulatory front, because Trump is gutting regulations left and right. And then they'll have to answer for the fact that after getting those gutted regulations, after passing the tax cuts, after putting a bogus infrastructure plan in place, the economy is still sputtering along because Republican policies don't help the economy. Democratic policies have, and they have since World War II.
Yeah, that's why we had the weakest recovery from the Great Recession in the history of economic literature.
Chris Roebling, Dave Lundy, touche, a good one. Getting angry at the end. Always like that. Thanks, guys.
I'm not angry.
Welcome back to The Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, it's not every day that we get a Hall of Famer in the building, but my next guest is just that, inducted to the Baseball Hall of Fame earlier this year. Tim Raines started his career as a second baseman in the Montreal Expos farm system, but quickly moved to the outfield, where he excelled as not just a great defender, but one of the best offensive players in baseball history. In 1981, Raines was cited by Sporting News as one of the players that changed baseball forever. His ability to get on base and then steal subsequent bases led to a surge in players with that skill. Raines had a tremendous career in Montreal, and he came here to Chicago in the early 90s to be part of the White Sox 1993 playoff run in the shortened 94 season, and he made his way back to Chicago as the first base coach for the World Series champs in 2005. Tim Raines has written a memoir about his life on the base path. It's called Rock Solid, My Life in Baseball's Fast Lane. In the book, he talks baseball, but also some off-the-field issues like drug addiction and lupus, the disease that ultimately forced him to retire. As a baseball fan of a certain age, it is my pleasure to welcome Tim Rock Raines to the big table tonight. Mr. Raines, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Let's get right to it. The first chapter, you get right into your drug addiction. I mean, is that on purpose to set the table for your career, to get that issue out of the way, the cocaine use in the early 80s?
Pretty much, but that's how my career kind of started. I mean, actually, you know, I got off to a great start my rookie season. You know, I stole 50 bases in the first 55 games. We go on strike. I ended up with like 71 in 88 games. And, you know, that's how it all got going. But shortly after that, you know, I got into the issues with drugs. And I still to this day wonder how in the heck I had such a good year that year. And kind of got through that with the help of, you know, realizing I had a problem, one. And the help of some great players, Andre Dawson, Gary Carter, and the rest of the crew that I was with, you know, Ellis Valentine and Warren Cromartie, Steve Rogers, guys like that, man, just kind of pulled together and kind of brought me on and made me realize, you know, that I'm a good player, so let's go out and play. You know, forget about all that other stuff. Let's go play some baseball. And that was all it took.
And it was surprising to me. I opened up the book a couple days ago, and I'm like, oh, I'm going to start. I'm sure we'll start with Small Town Story, but you got right into it as the first chapter. You know, when you talk about Andre Dawson, you talk about some of the other players in the Expos, you really do talk about how those players helped you as you were dealing with the addiction and the rehab afterwards. And you also talk in the book about falling in with a wrong crowd, players that didn't care necessarily, that you know, helped with your partying ways. Mm-hmm. You know, when you think about playing at the professional level and you talk about the groups and the players that you hang out with, how important is it? How important is it to find yourself with the right crew?
It's important, but I think when you're young, you don't really understand that part of the game yet, you know. And another thing, back in those days, the veteran guys kind of treated the rookies like you got to earn your way to be one of us, you know. I mean, we had to polish shoes and carry big stereos around, you know, on the plane and off the plane. I mean, we had to do a lot of stuff. I mean, we could only speak when we were spoken to. Unfortunately, and thank God, you know, that I was an everyday player when I first got up there, that guys kind of took care of me and I didn't have to do a lot of that, a lot of that stuff. But, you know, back in the day, that was really, really a situation with veterans and younger players. So even though I didn't have to go through that, but, you know, I kind of hung out with some guys, you know, that were older and that had time in the major leagues. And, you know, at that time, unless, you know, you don't know who to hang out with, you know, here I am a small town guy. I'm from a really small town in Florida, and I go to Montreal. I don't speak the language. It's hard to, you know, get along with anyone there other than your teammates. Right. And, you know, if you don't know many teammates, it's kind of hard to fit in other than on the field. So it was just a situation. It was a partying town. I mean, one of the most partying towns in all of Major League Baseball. I mean, if you can ask anyone that ever came to Montreal, had never been there before or realized how, you know, things are in Montreal, it's very easy. I mean, you know, there were guys, I'm not going to mention their name, but there were guys that, you know, when they came to Montreal, they didn't go to the hotel first. They would go to some
go
club,
to a bar,
you know,
right.
a bar or something. So that was how it was. I mean, fortunately or unfortunately for me, you know, that's how it got started.
Yeah.
You know, when and I never was like that. In the minor leagues, I was never like that. In high school, I've always been the kind of guy that, you know, came to work, did my job, and tried to be the best that I could be. But all of a sudden, I've gotten to the major leagues, and, you know, you're 21, 20 years old. I mean, right. I didn't go to college, but it's like being in college without being in college.
And not to mention, I mean, you had such a great rookie year. You were famous. I mean, you were a celebrity in Montreal mm-hmm. in the way that at that time the Expos fans were rabid for the team, and you were the young star on the team. So there's a lot that goes into celebrity and culture.
And that happened overnight. You know, my first couple of call-ups, you know, I pinch ran. I mean, I was successful running. But when the first opportunity I got, you know, to swing the bat didn't go so well. You know, I was 1-for-20. I batted like 50 in my first, like,
that's hard to believe. Yeah.
Right, at trying to be an all-around player. But, you know, my first full year, things turned around. Not only for me, for the team as well. And that was a big part of the success for that team.
I think about that, and I kind of reference the sporting news talking about you and other players, young players, rookies coming in that were changing the game of baseball. And there's really an emphasis on the way that you played, the way that it almost was the beginning of what we kind of know as a five-tool player, mm-hmm. this idea that you could steal bases, you could hit for a switch hitter, you could had an on-base percentage that was through the roof, you're a defensive player. I mean, you really were a prototype of players that really the league hadn't seen yet. Did you think about it that way as a rookie when you were coming up, that you could do things that other players couldn't?
Not necessarily, because, you know, at the major league level, I hadn't done anything yet. So I kind of had to prove not only to the organization, the team, Major League Baseball, that, and myself, that, you know, I could play at the major league level. I remember my last year in the minor leagues, I was minor league player of the year. I did everything I needed to do in the minor leagues. There was nothing else for me to do at the minor league level. But, you know, the next step was trying to do that kind of stuff at the major league level.
Yeah.
And until you have some success, you know, you're always going to kind of doubt yourself until it actually happens. And I think opening day in 81, my first year, first full season, not only that I'm not playing second base anymore, I'm playing the outfield.
Yeah, right.
I lead off the game. We're in Pittsburgh. My first at bat, battle, get a walk. And then I take off on the first pitch. Ball gets away, hits me, gets away, trickles off into the outfield, and I score on that play.
And everyone's like, whoa.
And I'm thinking, you know, wow. You know, it's not that easy, but,
that was
you
easy.
Know, that was encouraging for
right,
me because,
right.
you know, I had never really seen that. And to do it in my first full season, first game, kind of got the ball rolling. I think if I would have struck out there and maybe not even got any hits in that game, who knows what would have happened, because the psyche of players is it's confidence.
I want to talk about that. I want to talk about the psyche. In studio with me, Tim Raines. He's the author of Rock Solid, My Life in Baseball's Fast Lane. Of course, the Hall of Fame baseball player for the Expos, the White Sox, the Yankees, other stops in between. But let's take a quick break so we can stay on time tonight, and we'll continue our conversation at the big table with Tim Raines. Stay with me. Welcome back to The Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. My guest in the studio at the big table, Tim Raines, the Major League Baseball Hall of Famer who played some time here in Chicago. We'll talk about that. He's got a new memoir, Rock Solid, My Life in Baseball's Fast Lane. You mentioned, right before the break, we talked about the psyche. You know, and you mentioned, you know, coming up and starting 1-for-20, only batting 50. A lot of what you do, and I think about stealing bases, is about confidence and about the idea of just willing yourself to win by inches.
Mm-hmm.
How important is it when you talk about psyche and confidence and issues of being mentally aware to the game of baseball?
I think it plays a big role. You know, as players, you know we can play the game, but until we actually go out and do it, there's an unsureness about that. At the major league level, it's a different story. The minor league level, sure, you know, you can probably be the best minor league player in baseball, but maybe you can't make it at the major league level. And I think you have to get over that hump. You know, I'm not in the minors anymore. I'm playing against the best players in the world, and I have to compete at that level. And you know, if you don't be consistent doing it, you won't be there long. And that's the one good thing, that you know if you don't play well, you're going to be out of town.
That's a great point. I mean, for you, I mean, you're a model of consistency. I mean, you could expect an over 300 batting average, a certain number of stolen bases. You were always competitive. How important is that? I mean, when you talk about, to think about some of the career stats you put up and to think about some years in Montreal where you're hitting 330, 335, like it was just, that's just normal. That's what you do. And obviously those numbers led you to the Hall of Fame. You know, as a player, as someone who is, okay, we know you're going to hit 330. We know you're going to steal 50, 60, 70, 80 bases. Do you buy into that? Do you feel like the confidence is there that you're like, I know I'm going to hit 330. I know I'm going to steal this base. I know I'm the kind of player that can do this.
Well, you know, you have to have that type of confidence within yourself. I mean, in order to be able to do it anyway, you have to have that talent. You know, once you realize you have it, you have to kind of use it to the fullest. And if you don't, then like again I said, you know, you never know how long you're going to be there. But I was always that guy that regardless how well I play one year, the next year I want to be better. You know, you always want to strive. You know, I try not to set certain goals. I just try to set a goal just to have the best year that I can have.
Yeah.
Not be injured, try to play as many games as I can. And if that happens, there's no telling what I can do. And I enjoy playing and thinking that way, because if you think that way, then you don't set yourself up for certain goals. And then once you achieve them, then you want to just kind of chill out. For
the rest
of
you
the
talk
year.
About a little bit in the book about the age of stats and, you know, guys that you were compared to and continued throughout your career, guys like Ricky Henderson come to mind. You know, even in the 90s, when you played in the 90s, it became almost like the only stat that mattered was how many times you hit the ball out of the ballpark. You know, for you, not thinking about stats and really hammering home that wasn't true. Is that real? I mean, as a player, you were not thinking about how many stolen bases you had, how many doubles, how many triples?
Not at all. I mean, and the people might say I'm lying, but I'm not. You know, I've never felt like if there was a target number, you know, say Ricky Henderson stole 130 bases. I'm not going to put myself in a position to say I want to steal more bases than Ricky Henderson stole this year and put myself in position to be so concerned about that, that I don't be concerned about the other part of the game. You know, I've always felt I never want to be that guy to say Tim Raines, he's a guy that stole a lot of bases. I wanted people to recognize me as a guy that played the game in every facet, you know, hitting, driving runs in, you know, stealing bases, yeah, but a hitter that, you know, when the game is on the line, you want him at the plate instead of, I don't know, and this guy's just a singles hitter.
Right,
you know, and I
wasn't a singles hitter.
I mean, I hit home runs. I wasn't a home run hitter, but, I mean, I averaged, you know, 10 to 12 home runs a year. But that wasn't what I was trying to do. If I hit home runs, that was cool. But I wanted people to recognize me as an overall player that did it all, you know, a 5-2 player, not just a guy that could run.
And I think that is that's why you're in the Hall of Fame. I mean, you're the original kind of player like that. I'm really interested in stealing bases, because that is when you think about, you get into the game of baseball, and it's funny because I don't think too many in this day and age, when you think of 2017, of guys who are stealing 70, 80, 90 bases. There's a couple guys, a guy down in Florida, D. Gordon steals bases. There's others who had done it. Then Marlin seemed to be the manufacturer guys who steal bases. But when I think of that concept, just the idea, the art of stealing a base. I think about the guy leading off. I think about the pitcher throwing over there, leaning, all that kind of mental stuff, the game, the strategy that's in it. Take us through that. I mean, were you a kind of player that was like, I'm going to lead off three steps and I'm going to run? Or were there intricacies? Were you watching for little tells in the pitcher? How much of it was chess to Tim Raines?
It was more chess. I mean, I knew every move pitcher would make. You know, I knew how quick they were to the plate. I knew what type of moves they had. I mean, I know if he set his feet one way, he's going to go one way. I mean, I really focused and studied pitchers. I mean, in order for me to be successful, I mean, yes, I could run. I mean, it doesn't matter how fast you can run, but, I mean, you cannot run a baseball. And that's the part of the game that I think people don't understand.
Yeah.
And most time when we're stealing bases, it's not so much off of the catcher. Usually it's off the pitcher. You know, if you gave a catcher time, they can throw anybody out. But
yeah, right.
if you got great jumps, if you were on your way to second before the guy even started going to the plate, it makes it so much harder for the catcher to, you know, one, they're gonna try to rush to try to throw you out, and then they've got to make perfect throws, because if you're there in time, if that ball throws off an inch or two, you're going to be safe.
It's amazing to me, too, because, and I know you want to be typecasted this way, but if Tim Raines gets on first base, Tim Raines is going to steal second. And as a fan, as everyone in the building and watching on TV is like, Tim Raines is going to try to steal second. The pitcher knows that. Everybody knows that. There's no element of surprise.
Right.
And yet you still do it. And yet you still make it. I mean, the amount of the percentage of stolen bases made versus caught is, I mean, that's why you're in the Hall of Fame, the idea that you rarely were caught. So the idea, how do you deal with the fact that the element of surprise is gone?
Well, that was the cool part about it, you know, knowing that everybody in the world, not just, you know, in that game or on that field or watching television, everybody knows I'm going. And to be able to know that and then be successful doing it makes you feel a little different, a little more different from other people. And it makes you a little bit special, but not to the point to where you're cocky or you feel like you're the best player in baseball or anything like that. But that's a skill that I feel like I could utilize in the game of baseball. That kind of gave me a feeling of my football background.
Right.
You know,
right.
You know, when you're playing football, everyone's trying to stop you from getting the first down or from getting the touchdown. And everybody know you're going to get the ball. But if you get it, and they know you're going to get it, but you still get around and you get a touchdown or a first down. That's the kind
that's
of feeling.
Sport. There's something about
and that's
the idea
feeling
that,
you know, that great players and great athletes want to have. And if you don't have that, then you shouldn't be playing at the professional level.
Right.
But that's just a feeling that you have. And not so much. I mean, some guys are cocky about it. But, I mean, I always just wanted to compete and compete at the highest level. And, you know, me against you, today, who's going to be the best? And it's not always going to be, I'm not always going to be the best, and I understood that. But I never, like, wavered from, okay, you got me today, tomorrow I'm going to get you, or I'm going to get you later on today. So that's the kind of way I played the game.
Baseball Hall of Famer Tim Raines in studio tonight. His memoir, Rock Solid, My Life in Baseball's Fast Lane, is out now. All right, we'll take a quick break. We'll get an update on the news. We'll come back. We'll continue the conversation with Tim Raines at the big table. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Download here on 720 WGN. My guest at the big table tonight, Tim Raines, the Hall of Fame, I would say Hall of Fame Expo, because you went in as an Expo, but we also know you as a Chicago White Sox. You played on a team, and a team that is dear to White Sox hearts, the early 90s teams that went to the playoffs and probably would have went again during the strike-shortened season. You also coached for Ozzie Guillen, coached first base on the teams that went and won the World Series. And you talked about, I mean, it's amazing to me that there are two strike-shortened seasons in baseball, and you were on two teams that were affected by it. And how do you view that? Because for the Expos in 81 or 82, they were, 81. You guys ended up going to the playoffs, so it worked out.
Right.
But in 94, in a position where you guys were in first place and didn't get a chance to finish it out. Do you think about that, the idea that two of your most successful seasons, playoff, and besides the stuff you did with the Yankees, were shortened by a strike?
Well, the one that comes to mind the most is the 94. You know, White Sox team, because, you know, the reason why I went, you know, ended up being traded and wanted to go to Chicago was for that reason. I had a young up-and-coming team, some great young players, Thomas, Ventura, great staff with Fernandez and Hernandez and, you know, Blackjack. I mean, we had a staff. I mean, we had some great players as well, so that one kind of comes to mind more than the 81 season, because
we still got to go to the playoffs.
Personally, in the 81 season, I felt like I was robbed, personally. But the 94 season, I felt like the team was robbed because, you know, we had some great players. We had proven that we were on our way on a rise, mm-hmm. on our way to hopefully becoming a world champion team. And, you know, that was taken away. The other cool thing about it was the 94 Expos was the best team in the National League.
Right. How great would that have been?
So, you know, just thinking about that, you know, the chances of me going to the World Series with the White Sox, which is the reason why I wanted to go, and then the Expos, you know, going to the World Series. Amazing, and huh? The reason why I left Montreal, because they wasn't going in that direction. I don't know what happened when I left, but that's the one year out of my whole career that I feel like I wish I could get a mulligan.
You talked about it in the book, and you talked about the difference of the cities that you played in. I mean, you talked about Montreal, and even at the beginning, they were really amped about baseball. But as time went on, and as we know the fabled story of Montreal moving to Washington, but the idea that the fan base kind of left the team up in Montreal. But in Chicago, you talked about the idea of it wasn't a North Side or South Side, it wasn't Cubs or White Sox, it was this love of baseball that the city provided.
And that's true. And, you know, when you look at the different cities in professional sports, you look at, you know, the big cities like New York, and you kind of put Chicago kind of in between, not as big media-wise as New York, but kind of in the middle, but big enough. Where you're going to be recognized, might not always be the top story, but and during that time too, the Bulls was kicking butt all the time. So yeah. I mean, there was,
well, I mean,
there
Michael was, Jordan retired while you guys were in. That's a famous story. You guys exactly. were in the playoffs and
so,
he retired.
So Chicago was and the football team was doing well as well. So and you know, and we in 91, you know, we had start proving that we were a good team as well. So. Mm-hmm. The city was really popping during those times, and it was a joy to play here. It was a joy to play in front of the fans. We had just got a new stadium. I didn't even play in the old stadium. I think I played one game, and that was an all-star game in the old stadium. So it was like a whole new way of being a White Sox.
You know, it's fun. It's fun to reading the book, and I didn't know this as a fan, but there, you know, you clean up the story of Rock Raines. You know, because right. when you came to Chicago, you were Rock Raines, and we're like, I thought we traded for Tim Raines. This is the All Star Montreal Expo. Who's Rock Raines? Is this his brother? But and you talked about that you made almost a name change when you came right. to Chicago, but it didn't stick.
No, what happened was, you know, when I first got over here, it's my first time in the American League, and I had a tough time against American League pitchers. You know, they pitched me totally different than the way I was for 11 years in the National League. Guys were throwing me fastballs, and I was hitting fastballs. I come over here, I couldn't get any fastballs. I mean, I was like, wow, they definitely pitched me a lot different over here, and it took me half the season to kind of make the adjustment. Actually, it started out Tim Raines, but I was having such a terrible time at the plate, man. I said, look, something is going to have to change. So I went to the PA announcer, and I talked to the front office and said, look, man, we're going to have to do something here. If anything, just instead of announcing me Tim Raines, announce me Rock Raines. And for at least 3 or 4 months, or maybe towards the end of that season, they started announcing, now I'm batting Rock Raines.
And that was your nickname from college or
from my first year in pro ball.
Yeah, pro ball.
And then people start asking, who's Rock Raines? I'm like, that's me, you know. But like, is that your real name? So it wasn't. I didn't change it from my real name. I just felt like, okay, I just need a little change here to kind of get me going. Once it gets me going, then we can go back.
What was was it Torberg who said Rock Raines has been waived and we just called up Tim Raines when you were in a slump? That was the thing. Right. When you're in a slump like that, when you're realizing, you know, you had. What, 8, 9, at this point, 10 years, yeah. 11 years in the league, yeah. and you come into a new environment and it's not going the way that you're used to as an all-star, as a player who can just turn it on. Mm-hmm. Paul, what does it mentally do to you? I mean, we hear baseball is a game of slumps, ups and downs, that kind of stuff, but as a guy who's only had success, only had consistency, on his way to a Hall of Fame career, what does it do when you're not the Tim Raines that you know?
Well, you don't know. You don't know, especially when you're in a new city, new league. You're playing against new players, so it's like starting all over again. And I didn't realize it was going to be that difficult. And until you actually do it, you don't think that is ever going to happen, you know, especially when, you know, your career is just going year after year, you're having good year after good year, and it's successful. That's all you think about. Okay, what I'm going to do next year? I'm going to have another good year. But see, well, we can kind of get a little better from one part of the game or another. But when you go to a new place, new town, new ballpark, you know, new teammates, you hope to continue to do the same thing they were doing with with the other organization, but you're not sure. And it's a big difference. It was a big difference between the National League and American League when it came to the style of play.
Yeah, right.
You got the DH, a lot more breaking balls, regardless of when they threw breaking balls. I mean, 3-0, I got curveballs. 3-1, I got breaking balls, some kind of breaking ball. And normally
they didn't even care
about walking me in the American League. So, I mean, partly the reason they're not going to walk me, so they're going to throw me fastballs, so I'm getting changeups, I'm getting breaking balls. So I'm like, eventually these guys are going to throw me a fastball, right. And it never happened. And that was the difference. I just didn't foresee that. You know, that wasn't going
to
change.
Well, you came back to your consistent ways with the White Sox, and you had a great years in 93, 94, 95. And you had a chance to move on and win a World Series with the Yankees. We'll skip that. We don't care about the Yankees. The interesting thing is how your career ended. And it was, it was an ailment. It was lupus that came on, and you had to treat it like cancer, chemotherapy, all of the things that you counted on, your body, your ability, everything that had made you who you were was taken away from you by this disease. What was that like? What was it like for you to be in that situation where you still wanted to play? I know Tim Raines still wanted to play, right. And you couldn't.
Well, first of all, I didn't really know what lupus was when I was diagnosed. And then I had to, had to research it and find out, what I had got myself into. I wasn't really worried about baseball at the time. I was worried about if I'm going to live.
Life, right.
I mean, how much time do I have? I mean, can I get over this? Is this something that's gonna be for the rest of my life? Can it be cured? And I found out all those answers, and it took me about 8 months to 10 months to finally starting to feel better. And I had to make a decision. I mean, I could have walked away from the game. I felt like I had a great career, but there was something I wanted to do before my career was over. And the reason why I came back, I had an opportunity to, get a chance to play in the Olympics.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt like I was ready. I went in and I worked out for the Olympic team. And I did well. I played in an independent league and did what I had to do. But It didn't work out. So if it hadn't been for that, I probably would have walked away from baseball.
Yeah.
And when I was turned down, probably the first time in my career that I was turned down for making a team, it inspired me. It inspired me to prove to baseball and to the Olympic team or the Olympic committee that I can make a major league team and I can't make an Olympic team. And that was all like minor league players. I can't make a major, but I can make a major league team. So
right.
I got ready. I did what I had to do. I went back to the Expos. They gave me an opportunity, which was love them for just giving me a chance. And that's all I wanted.
Right.
I mean, if I wasn't good enough, then send me home. And that would have been cool with me because, I did what I could
do.
Right. But I went there. I made the team. I was opening day starter for a Montreal team.
That was
a young team. But, after that, it was all – that's all I wanted. I wanted to prove that I could still play. And I had a good season. I think I batted over 300 that
year. Of course
year.
You did. And, Tim Raines, right?
Yeah. And ended up getting a chance to play with my son at the end of that season.
Yeah, that's great. There's great stories in the book. And, go check it out. Rock Solid, My Life in Baseball is Fast Lane. It's a memoir of Tim Raines. The last thing you talk about is being inducted into the Hall of Fame, which just happened in January. And, you get to be alongside Andre Dawson as an Expo, and you get a chance to be among the best that have ever played the game. What does it mean to you to have, after the whole season, the career you had, starting as an unbelievable rookie, having the drug problem that was highly public, to going through the seasons, to winning a World Series, to having lupus and then turning it around? What's it mean to you to be a Hall of Famer?
Oh, it means everything. I mean, from where I started, young kid from a small town, being drafted to play with a team I didn't really even know about when I was drafted. And it took me a while to believe that baseball was going to be the sport that I ended up playing. I mean, I felt like I was going to give myself 2 years. two full seasons and see what happens. If I would have failed, then I would have like went to college and played football. That was my second choice.
Your fallback, right?
Right. So I'm thinking, you know, baseball is cool, but I don't know if I can play baseball. But I got a backup plan.
As a Hall of Famer says.
Right,
usually,
but thank
right?
God it worked out the way it did. You know, I never really, you know, when I first started and I made the major leagues, Hall of Fame was the last thing from my mind. You know, it was taking one day at a time and trying to be a major leaguer for as long as I could be a major leaguer. And even when it was over for me, I didn't think about the Hall of Fame. I know I had a great career. I think playing in Montreal, I didn't get the notoriety that a lot of other players got throughout their careers around the same time. But I knew I had a great career. So I knew it was going to take some doing for, you know, hopefully I had enough reporters that knew enough about me that would get me in. But if it didn't, you know, it wasn't the end of the world if I didn't get in. Yeah. So by it being 10 years, you know, people thought I was upset for all those 10 years. I wasn't upset. I mean, I just felt like if it was meant to be, it's meant to be. And now I don't have to answer that question anymore.
It's meant to be. Tim Rock Raines in studio, the memoir Rock Solid, My Life in Baseball's Fast Lane. Mr. Raines, a pleasure to talk to you. Thanks for being my guest and talking about your career.
Oh, thanks for having me, man.
Pretty awesome to sit across from Tim Rock Raines. Think back to my days. I couldn't help it. I wanted so bad to just name off some of those Expo players that he played with. In the book, it's a who's who of 80s baseball players.
Oh, yeah.
Tim Wallach.
Cub killer.
A lot about Tim Wallach in the book. Andres Galarraga, as Harry used to say. Good stuff. Someone texted in, and this is good because it was something I thought about in the interview too, but I didn't go there about because he talked about the drug use at the top. But and he talks about this urban myth that he only slid head first because he was afraid that he would disturb his cocaine that was in his pocket.
Hmm.
That's like the urban myth to Tim Raines. And he references in the book that there was an ugly rumor around, you know, that that's sort of why everyone thought that he, you know, played head first, which is not, if you know baseball and he's a base stealer.
Yeah.
That's what you do, mm-hmm. right? And he said it's not the case. And you know, there's a lot of confusion about his nickname, Rock. Everyone thinks that Rock had something to do with rock, like rocks, cocaine rocks, mm-hmm. which is not the case. He was short. He was short and stocky. They called him Rock because his physique.
Yeah.
He had that before.
Yeah, he was in high school, he said. Then yeah. he didn't. To start doing the drugs or whatever until he was a pro.
Yeah. I know. There's at least a little bit of information in the book about the Montreal party scene.
I was very interested in that. Because in as such as that Montreal has always been, you know, a place that it's on my list of places I'd like to go.
Right.
When he said that, my ears kind of perked up.
You're like, oh, what's going on?
Canadian club scene.
Right.
You know how I do.
Yeah, I know. That's how you do. Yeah. When I think of you, Pete Rock, Zimmerman. All right, coming up in the 9 o'clock hour, Liz Dozier's here. Liz Dozier, of course, the star of CNN's Chicagoland. She was a principal at Fenger High School. That show that documentary, newsmentary, mm-hmm. whatever, about Chicago, and she was the star of it, and she is now the managing director at Chicago Beyond. They're doing their second annual innovation challenge. Essentially, what Chicago Beyond does, this is interesting, they're sort of venture philanthropy, where they will give money to not-for-profits who are coming up with ideas to take on issues like youth safety or education. And instead of just having everybody kind of put the grant proposal in, they've changed it up this year with all you have to do is put a 90-second video up on their site. They got Chance the Rapper involved. So we'll talk with Liz Dozier coming up here.
Great.
The 9 o'clock hour. Also tonight, Chef Marcela Valladolid. Did I get that right? Valladolid.
Yeah. Congratulations. That's a tough one.
Casa Marcela, Recipes and Food Stories of My Life in the Californias. She is the co-host of The Kitchen with Jeff Morrow, one of the Chicago famed mm-hmm. Jeff Morrow. But she's on The Kitchen. That's a popular show. And I learned. Do you watch The Kitchen?
No.
It's on. I think it's on the weekends, but they just run it like crazy. It's one of those things like in the morning. I saw it today. I learned of it because they marathon those things. So one holiday in recent memory, I can't remember when, but it was at the in-laws. And it was just like back to back to back to back to back to back to back The Kitchens. So I watched it and I learned a lot about how to make watermelon salad. It's a good show. But yeah, she's one of the co-hosts. She's also tremendously, she's all over the place. This book is less recipes and more coffee table book. The pictures are just tremendous of her house in I think it's in Chula Vista out by San Diego. So we'll talk about Mexican food. We'll talk about her life. She's great. So that's coming up as well in the 9 o'clock hour. And then 10 o'clock tonight, Mooner's back. It was funny. I will say this. Mooner and the Chicago band, Lee Ketch, one of the first bands to ever be in Studio 435. Lee is back at the Hideout. And it's funny because when I saw Mooner on the schedule, I was like, oh, cool. I'm like, how do I know this band? Right? And then I started to work on it. And I was like, and then they had something up on social media. It's like, hey, we're on WGN. I'm like, oh, one of the other shows must have had them. Right? And they had a video and I pressed play and it was me introducing them. And I'm like, oh, yeah. I know these guys. I know Lee. Like, it took me a second. It was like a moment. I told Bob, I was like, what's happening to my life? How did I forget this? Where's that shirt? I don't even know where that shirt's at. That's a vibe I had.
With the amount of interviews that you do, I'm surprised that you remember any of these people.
Well, I mean,
I mean, there's just so many, course of a year.
It does. I mean, you have to kind of move forward. It's hard to look back. But, I mean, you have these great conversations. You know, Liz, this will be the second time Liz is on tonight.
Is she on before?
Yeah, we talked to her. Chicago Beyond. We talked to her when she took over that job. So it's kind of great to catch up with her and be able to add on top of what we talked about. You know, hopefully I get another shot to talk to Tim Raines in my life. So I can be like, Tim, let's get it straight, Tim. Let's talk about the head first slide. See how he vibes with that. Well, it'll be interesting to see, in 2 years' time, 3 years' time, when you're on your fifth interview with people, if I can keep the narrative going. If I can be, last time I talked to you, this is where we ended. Let's pick up. As opposed to, tell me again what you do. And then
right, yeah.
Back, you know? I think we do a good job.
Yeah, you're always advancing the narrative.
Get advanced the ball. Yeah. Right. You got to move it forward.
Yeah.
Right. Did you have a good weekend?
I had a great weekend. It was I didn't do anything.
You told me in confidence that you were having heating problems, heating and air conditioning problems, in the way that one of your rooms is not heating or air conditioning.
Right, yeah.
How is that? I know I don't want to bring up personal stuff.
It's okay. Yeah, the bedroom, Justin, is hot.
That's your business.
Do you bring this up just for that joke? Kudos, because that was a good one.
That's a good one. I know. I feel like every time I have a similar situation where one of my son's room is kind of like that, where it's hotter than the rest of the house. Mm-hmm. And I kind of feel guilty about it because I'm like, if you go into my bedroom, it's nice.
Perfect.
Yeah, it's like everything is perfect.
You're sleeping like a baby.
Yeah, I go into my son's room. I'm like, it's a little sticky in here. Well, we don't have to deal with that. You're okay. You're all right. You're not complaining. You don't know any better. So we'll just, you know, like, it's not excruciating. It's just there. So I know I got to talk to, you know, it's exciting because I got to talk to Steve Dale because I think that I'm going to go for a cat.
You guys are going to get an animal.
Yeah,
all right.
For his birthday coming up here. Yeah, so that we're working on it.
Oh, man.
We just started the con. You don't think that's a good idea?
No.
No, it's a great idea.
Get him another PlayStation or something. Don't do a cat. Come on.
No, that's a great idea.
I got Angel and Devil in the studio here. I agree with you a little bit, Rob. It's hard to pull the trigger on. But I was like, I told my wife, I'm like, all right, well, we got a guy. Steve Dale, who will help us through the experience, right?
He's not going to talk you out of it, I don't think.
No,
he's
I went on my own to one of the shelters. We went as a family to go. I think I told the story. We went into one of the rooms, and they wouldn't really let us in the rooms because they're like, it's kind of one of the cats is not getting along with the other cats. So you're just I'm like, well, then get the other cat out of there so we can look at these cats. That's the whole idea, right? So they finally let us in after, you know, enough sort of peer pressure, you know, breathing by the door. And lo and behold, about 4 minutes in, one of the cats attacks the other one. There's a coach cat fight. I mean, a legitimate cat fight where one of them jumps to the ceiling, like six of them getting in the business, you know, with a couple more just kind of lounging close. And that was that. I'm like, let's take a break on this process. Let's just, you know, we'll figure it out later. So we got to get back in. So maybe Steve can help.
Yeah, you can know. Yeah, cat. Well, I don't know.
I like cat. I think cat better than dog, but I love a
cat.
Dog
cat's very easier.
Yeah.
Although, you know, our cat, you know, and, you know, God bless my wife for taking care of it because, you know, the cat will wake up at 2 a.m. and start slapping things off the counters. And then, you know,
for food or what?
Yeah, it's just because he's a dick.
All right, good to know. That's a strike against the cat.
FYI.
Yeah, FYI.
Be prepared.
The great thing at the Martier household in the Northwest suburbs is that I've told my kids there are no animals of any kind until you guys learn to pick up your toys. I've got 3,100 square feet of toys in every room. We will never be getting an animal, ever.
That's good. That's good. All right. I'm learning stuff. I'm hearing both sides. I like it. Thanks, Rob. It is the download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Coming up 9:30 tonight, Casa Marcela, Chef Marcela Valladolid, who is did I come close on that, Pete? It's good. Who is the longtime Food Network star, and she is the chef who co-hosts on The Kitchen on the Food Network, which you can see on the weekends here with Jeff Morrow, of course, from Chicago as well. She's got a new book. She's in town for an event, so she'll be my guest a little bit later in the hour. Looking forward to talking with her. And, of course, at Studio 435 tonight, Lee Ketch from the band Mooner will be performing live. Excited he's going to be at the Hideout this weekend. Well, late last week, it was announced that Chicago Beyond, the Venture Philanthropy Fund, has launched its second annual Innovation Challenge, giving not-for-profits with the best idea to help take on issues like youth safety or education, giving them up to $2 million in prizes. To raise awareness, Chicago Beyond connected with Chance the Rapper to get help to help get the word out on the project. So I'm sure there's a lot of paperwork, and then there's meetings, and then there's more paperwork and meetings if you want to get involved. Oh, there's not. No. You can actually explain your idea in a 90-second video. It's part of how they're changing things over at Chicago Beyond. In studio, Liz Dozier, former principal for Fenger High, starred in the CNN show Chicagoland. She's the managing director at Chicago Beyond. Liz, great to see you.
Thanks for having me.
No, thanks for being here. All right, so let's talk about this. First off, you did the Innovation Challenge last year.
Mm-hmm.
What did you learn from it that got you to the point where you wanted to change the rules?
So we just wanted to be able to allow more nonprofits who perhaps don't have the fancy grant writers, right? They don't have the person who's sitting back and just like pumping out grants and writing fancy things. We want to allow them to have access to the same type of resources and supports. We wanted to make the process more equitable. So we're hoping that by having the first step be this video, it will open up.
You know, let's talk about that. I mean, what are you looking for in the video? I mean, when you kind of talk about outside the box and being creative with the approach, I mean, it's really about ideas that are really looking to tackle issues, two different issues, youth safety and education.
Yeah, we see those as two flip sides of the same coin, right? In some of our most marginalized communities here in the city, you cannot separate education and youth safety. You just can't. Like, literally, if children don't feel safe going to and from school or don't feel safe inside of the school, like, we can't expect them to learn. And so that's why those are our bucket areas at Chicago Beyond. We just firmly believe that that's what's going to help turn the tide.
You think
so? Investments in those areas. We do. We really do.
I mean, you saw it. I mean, it's a terrible story last weekend at the playground in Pill Hill that there was a shooting there. And then there was some of the same kids were at that playground. We're at 31st Street Beach. So they were affected by the shooting in both different places. When you think about the way violence and the way it's sort of taking over Chicago, you know, do you think that being able to tackle these issues are going to help at the core of that issue?
We do. Ultimately, like, people don't wake up and just want to shoot people, right? Like, there's a process and a reason why people become the way they do. Like, our communities aren't just the way they are just because people have nothing better to do, right? It's about historical stuff around trauma, education, disinvestment. I mean, there's all these, like, root issues that are starting to bubble up, and that's why we're seeing what we're seeing now in our communities. And so we believe that if we want to see a different society, ultimately, we have to make investments in these two key areas of youth safety.
Are there specific, I mean, I think about the not-for-profits who would be interested in this, and I think of, you know, the big dogs that you mentioned, the ones with grant writers and the ability to get the money. But, I mean, are there a lot of different organizations that are popping up to serve this issue, to take on the issue of education or safety?
Yes. I mean, if you look at who won last year, so look at the Dovetail Project or look at Story Catchers. I mean, these are smaller organizations serving a very niche population, but we believe that the work that they do will turn the tide. So if you look at Story Catchers, that functions in the youth detention centers and Illinois prisons here for young people. Like, their whole thing is getting, supporting people, like, literally at the crux of their vulnerability when they're in detained, and then supporting them afterward. The Dovetail Project deals with young fathers, like, who are not working and not in school, and really brings them into the fold, if you will, connects them to the Dovetail Project and provides them not only a pathway back to school or back to work, but, you know, gives them something to be attached to. And so those young men before, what were they doing? Nothing. But, you know, being a part of the Dovetail Project will shift that. And so we think there's a lot more programs out there like that. Absolutely.
What I like about what you guys are doing is it's not just sort of awarding a grant or giving prize money and saying, hey, go get them. Okay, next. What's next? I mean, there's an attachment with Dovetail, or there's an attachment with Story Catchers where you guys work together to figure out how you're going to use the money, how it's going to develop, all the kind of things that you don't normally see with
totally.
DC.
You or, never see it. Well, yeah. What you typically see in the foundation space is, like, I, as a foundation, have this really great idea. You can have this money, but you're going to execute on it like this. At Chicago Beyond, we say absolutely not. We think that there's value in community voice. We think there's value in the knowledge that's there. And so we say, hey, we value you and what you have to bring to the table. Let us, if you know, if there's synergy between us and the organization, let's help support your idea. Let's build that up. And that's impact. That's true impact, you know?
So for you, I mean, getting involved in this and having this be your life's work, I mean, talk about the idea of trying to find organizations and fund organizations that are going to find new ways to tackle this issue.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's a challenge, right? I mean, that's why we're, you know, here on talking about it and trying to get the word out to people, because oftentimes folks don't know about these opportunities. And so we want to make sure that the playing field is level. Oftentimes the big dogs, if you will, or the usual suspects know exactly how to, you know, access money and resources.
Does that surprise you? I mean, coming from outside of that world?
Oh, and I was in that world. I was on the other side of that world. So I know exactly
what
it is.
You're one of the big dogs, right?
No, not one of the big dogs. I was one of the community folks writing a proposal, you know, trying to figure out how to get money, and knowing that my vision was to do this, but instead of being able to do that, I had to shift something because if I wanted this money, here's how I had to execute.
Yeah, right.
You know, so I know firsthand what that is, you know, knowing how to serve my kids but not being able to do it. So when thinking about ultimately building Chicago Beyond, it's like, really, like acknowledging people have, like, people in the community aren't stupid. You know what I'm saying? Right. They're not. There's value there. And so we honor that at Chicago Beyond.
How do you do that? I mean, if they're going to bring the ideas and you're going to be creative in the way that you're going to overhaul the process in which people can submit by doing a 90-second video.
Yeah.
How do you get them to think that their idea is an idea that can be funded, as opposed to, like, your situation you were talking about, where you're like, I know what I want, but I also know what I can get. Does that make sense? Like, how do you get them to truly believe, to take the risk and say, this is my idea, this is what I want to do, without having that thought in their head where they're like,
totally.
No, Chicago Beyond's only going to give me money if I do this.
Let me tell you, that's like one of the biggest challenges we found with our partners, that they're so used to functioning with philanthropists in, like, this way of,
right,
you tell me what to do. And so it's a lot of, like, relationship building. It's a lot of sitting down together and hammering things out together. It's almost not to sound trite, but it's like giving people permission to say, hey, we're not operating in typical ways. We really want to, you know, honor, again, honor your voice, honor the knowledge that you bring to the table. These are the people that are at the ground doing the work every single day. Who knows better than them? So it's really important. And we think we have a lot to learn from them. Hence why we partner with the University of Chicago, right? There's a lot to be learned from the Dovetail Project, from Story Catchers. I mean, there just is.
Liz Dozier is the managing director at Chicago Beyond, and she's got the Innovation Challenge, her second annual Innovation Challenge, which is up for a couple more weeks, right? And you can go to the site
until July 7th
and upload your idea in a 90-second video of how you would use the money or be your idea to tackle issues of youth safety. Or
yeah, we just want to know. So we're looking for 501c3s, and people can go to chicagobeyond.org to get all the specifics. We're looking for nonprofits who have a program, they have an idea, something they're executing on, and we just want to like hear more about it. We just want to make it equitable. You know, we want it. Again, you don't need a fancy grant writer. All you need is a phone.
You know, for we were talking a little bit beforehand, you know, because this is something almost like a pet project of mine on the show to talk about how we see the future of funding social mm-hmm. issues. And we've been having conversation with the Metropolitan Planning Council and others about, as we see more and more governmental agencies, whether it be local, state, we see in state, federal, that are debating whether or not to even fund things. At the federal government, they're having a debate to say zero things mm-hmm. out, mm-hmm. which is crazy to think about. But they're you sort of see a world in 10, 15, 20 years from now where there will be more pressure on not-for-profits, on the business communities and others to pick up the slack and be able to put, you know, ideas to work and fund different ideas mm-hmm. that might be taking on social issues that the government has just abandoned. I mean, do you see it that way? Do you see a world in which, you know, you're taking on the issues of education or youth safety by yourself without the government, without other sort of money from taxpayers coming to help out?
Well, I mean, it's a little bit of a scary thought, right? Because, I mean, ultimately, nonprofits are funded by philanthropists, right? Or by some government agencies. And so, but a lot of it is philanthropy. And so it's scary to think of a world in which only, like, the nonprofits are doing that type of, mm-hmm. I mean, because ultimately, like, that means philanthropists are getting to set the agenda. So what if, you know, philanthropist A doesn't believe in education, or philanthropist B doesn't believe in, you know, the most marginalized kids and communities? Like, then what happens to those folks? Government, in my mind, should be the big equalizer, right? The nonpartisan, the kind of looking out for everyone and seeing it from this, you know, holistic perspective. So it's scary to think about a world in which, you know, philanthropists are picking up what is supposed to be, in my opinion, done by the government.
Well, then how do you do it? I mean, as more and more governments, you know, will prioritize and say the federal government says, well, we're just going to fund the military, or the state government says, well, we're going to do this, that, and the other. We have pension liabilities and mm-hmm, things like that. Mm-hmm. You know, how do you see, as yourself, a thought leader in this town, how do you see the city, the state, and other governmental agencies being able to fund things that on the surface are helping things, but you know, the idea of, you know, youth safety leading to education to help stem the tide on violence is one of those things where it's tough for a government to say, yes, it's working.
Yeah. You know what I mean? Like, well, it's long term. I think that type of stuff is like, it's long term investment, right? It's not like you're not going to see the fruit of education in, you know, 6 months. You know, it's like a long term investment that you see the residuals of it, you know, over time, over years. And I think that's part of the problem that we face here, is that we want these, like, you know, two second solutions, these silver bullet solutions. And, you know, we expect to see the results. I don't think it's feasible.
Yeah,
in my opinion, it's not feasible. But I'm going to tell you what, I'll tell you this much. If we don't begin to take seriously what is happening in our city by making investments in education and in some of these marginalized communities, it will only continue to get worse. I've said this for years. The chickens have just come home to roost. You cannot continue to, you know, you just can't continue to have disinvestment in communities, lack of education, like, and just think like, oh, it'll just, you know, it'll just be those communities over there on the south and west sides. It won't. It will begin to affect all of us. And I've said it for years. That's exactly what's happening. You know, ultimately, we will rise and we will fall together as mm-hmm. one city. It's a beautiful thing about the whole thing. We rise and fall together.
Well, I mean, for you, I mean, we were able to see you and your struggles on CNN when you did the Chicagoland show a couple years back, and what you had to deal with at Fenger, not just with funding or trying to keep the lights on at the school, which was alarming, but also having to develop relationships with the kids. As you think about that time and you think now you've moved on to other parts of your life and you look back to that time, I mean, is it better? Is it the same? Is it worse? I mean, what emotion comes up with you from being in that situation and now looking at it from a different side?
Yeah. Well, I haven't really moved on, really. I mean, I don't think you have an experience like that leading in, you know, at Fenger or in a community and being so connected and you just sort of like pack up one day and you're gone. You know, I'm still connected to the kids. I still was talking to one of my former students earlier today and just lost another student a couple months ago. One of my all-time favorite kids, Jason Barrett, was shot and killed a couple months ago. And so I don't leave it behind. I think that I'm sorry, I lost my train of thought on that. But it's hard, you know, because I don't feel like I've moved on. I think that the work that we're doing at Chicago Beyond is critical, but I think that we're one player at the table. There's a lot of other, you know, philanthropic and other organizations in the city that are looking to step up.
I mean, the second part of the question was just, do you see, you know, from a different, not moving on, but from a different job?
Yeah.
Do you see it getting better, getting worse? Do you have any sort of perspective that you could give us that the WGN radio listener doesn't have?
I mean, I see it as getting worse. I don't see it as getting any better in the very immediate. I think the numbers would tell you that in a lot of ways, in the aggregate. I mean, as long as we continue to have people being shot in the streets, or, you know, two little girls in the, you know, and a playground, you know, being shot in broad daylight. I mean, I don't think we can say it's getting any better. I don't.
Right. You know, as more and more conversation happens about funding and about, you know, what you do, but also what the city does and schools and education and everything, it reminds me that there's a lot of work to be done. And do we have I don't want to say political capital. Do we have the community capital to get it done? Do you see more and more of Chicago just putting their hands up in the air going, there's no way to fix this? This happens, like you just kind of mentioned. This happens in certain neighborhoods. There's nothing we can do. You know, now the it's just a number in the newspaper. Nobody seems to care. I mean, where are we at with the community?
Yeah,
capital?
I think as a whole, in some ways, we've become desensitized. I mean, I was so taken aback once I left the school and I began that my office is here downtown now, and was so just taken aback by these Monday morning conversations where people like almost like gather around the water cooler and talk about like, oh, can you believe so many people were shot and killed? And they would talk about the numbers or the different incidents that made the news. And it was almost as if people were discussing the Sunday night football game, you know? I mean, really, like it was just like this, it blew me away. But what I do believe, even despite that, is that there are good people and good programs in the city of Chicago who are fighting against this. And I don't believe that all hope is lost. I see it in Dovetail and Story Catchers and the other programs we've invested in, like One Goal. Like people are, you know, pounding that pavement every single day on behalf of kids. And that, I think that's inspirational and gives us all hope.
Well, that goes right into what we're talking about tonight, the second annual Innovation Challenge put on by Chicago Beyond. You can go to chicagobeyond.org and you can upload a 90-second video with your idea on how you would tackle issues pertaining to youth safety and to education. Liz Dozier is the managing director at Chicago Beyond. She's my guest tonight. Liz, great to see you. Thanks for being
Thanks
here.
Thanks for having me.
Great to see Liz Dozier, huh? I would love to have her back. I mean, talk about that all night. I think there's a conversation to be had about where our focus is as a community. And it could be media, it could be people, it could be neighbors. But we seem to put a focus and we shine a light on the numbers. And we let the numbers dictate the news story. And, you know, there's something to be said about data doesn't lie. But I wonder if we changed if we shifted the paradigm and said that the stories that are worth telling are the stories of people in community trying to make a difference or trying to do something better, right, are trying to rid themselves or their communities or other communities of issues like violence or gangs or down the line, and put a premium on those stories. You know, instead of it being the feel-good story that's at 10:20 on the news, when one woman, or 10:30, one woman making a difference. But that's not as important as some of the other stories that are in our city. I just wonder if we shifted that, if we, you know, as a community, put more emphasis on telling the stories of people of service, in service of any service. And instead of it being public affairs or what you get Sunday mornings or the kicker story, it became your lead story. If that would have any impact on the world that we live. So I don't know. I love the ability to be on the radio and talk about this stuff and have different great, not my thoughts, but other people's thoughts to come in and share them. Liz Dozier fits that bill. So we got to have her back so we can talk more about even when whoever wins the challenge, you know, and also, you know, talk about how they're developing it or the other organizations that Chicago Beyond are working. So we'll work that out. All right. Lots to do. We're moving on. We're going to talk with Chef Marcela Valladolid, who is going to be in studio right after the news. I'm very excited to talk to her about her book, Casa Marcela. So cool. It's so good. It's recipes, but it's also food stories and pictures from her house in Southern California. So we'll talk with her. She, of course, the co-host of The Kitchen on the Food Network, other shows on the Food Network. So that's coming up. Welcome back to Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, it's time for Industry Night, our weekly segment that focuses on food and hospitality. Last week, we talked about the grain economy. The week before that, we talked breakfast with Chef Jimmy Banos Jr. And this week, we taste the flavors of Mexico, or at least talk about them. It's not every day we get a Food Network star up in the studio. Marcela Valladolid is a chef who co-hosts The Kitchen and other shows, including hosting her own series, Mexican Made Easy. She's out with a new cookbook called Casa Marcela, Recipes and Food Stories of My Life in the California. She is in Chicago for a sold-out event, and she is my guest tonight. Chef Marcela, thanks for being here. Appreciate it.
Oh, thank you for having me. I would have brought food with me so you could taste it, but I literally just got off the plane and came here. So
No. Save that for the event tomorrow night for the lucky people who have tickets. All right. I'm fascinated. I mean, Casa Marcela is a cookbook.
Yes.
But it really, like I said, it's recipes and food stories of my life in the Californias. Let's talk about the food stories. Why say recipes and food stories?
Because I think it was I've talked about it so much, what it was like to live in the Tijuana, San Diego region my whole life. And I really wanted this book to just reflect that lifestyle. You know, we're living in a time when there's so much division and talks about walls and all these crazy things. And for us that are there, that actually live there, it's not even, there's no border. Mm-hmm. You just go back and forth. I spent the first 30 years of my life in Tijuana. I would cross the border, go to school in San Diego, back and forth all day, every day. My children are living the exact same life. They speak both languages. They're exposed to both cuisines, to all of the ingredients of Mexico's, because sometimes I'll grocery shop down there in the market when I can't find whatever I need in San Diego. So that's completely shaped not only my food, but who I am. So that's what I wanted to talk about, you know, when I say food stories.
Yeah, I mean, and it really, I mean, you talk about the proximity, the idea of only being 10, 15 minutes away from Mexico, and the idea of being to celebrate those flavors, because, you know, it's kind of like the Mediterranean down there. You got the Pacific Ocean. You talk about this concept that there is something very, very unique about the flavors of that area.
100%. And I think, and that's breaking, and I try to do this, like I feel this is my mission, like breaking those misconceptions that people have about Mexican food being just this or just that. But regionally, it's just like we're the most biodiverse country in the world. Right? So that's going to give for a gazillion ingredients and so many different ways to serve, prepare, and eat food. And sometimes, not in Chicago, because you have fabulous Rick Bayless, so you guys know Mexican food.
Sure, of course.
But for the most part, or when I was starting 20 years ago, I'm so old. but when I was starting 20 years ago, the misconception was pretty huge still, regardless of the fact that there were like a gazillion of us Mexicans here in the U.S., the misconceptions were still huge. And in northern Mexico, where I grew up, in Baja specifically, in Tijuana, we have a beautiful, gorgeous Mediterranean weather. Mm-hmm. Gorgeous. So, and we have all the fresh ingredients from the Pacific Ocean. We have all of the ingredients that you can find in the Mediterranean. So it's a combination of traditional technique, flavor, recipes, ingredients, kind of mixed in with all that Mediterranean flair, which gives for a lighter, not on purpose, but healthier cuisine. Mm-hmm. And that's what I like to talk about as well.
What's also there is tradition.
Yes.
And the tradition of family. Yes. And home. And yes. there's a lot in the book. I mean, because it's not just a collection of recipes. I mean, you're talking about your story.
Yes.
And your story revolves around the home, Casa Marcela.
Yes.
Talk about that. Talk about how you came up and how you used the traditions of your family to influence the work that you do now.
Yeah, and I mentioned that in the book. My dad is still known for his entertaining. He doesn't do it as much because my mom passed away. But he would, and I remember this when I was a kid, he would literally open the door to our home in Tijuana, Colonia Cacho, that was our neighborhood. He would open up the door at around 3 or 4 p.m., and that door would not close until like 3 or 4 a.m. the next day. Friends coming in and out, food being cooked, food being served, drinks, tequila. We had, I remember, he had at the bar this barrel of tequila that just seemingly never ran out of tequila. He just kept feeling it, I guess, when we weren't watching. But and it was always about family. It was always about family. It was always about his friends. It was always about the community. It was always about who was ever around. I mean, I would just remember him telling his friends, we're just going to be here all evening.
Yeah.
So drop in, come by. And the food was always a huge part of it. It like gave him like this huge sense of pride to be able, like he was like, my spread, it has to be the best spread and all of Tijuana. So the food was just a really, really, really important part of it.
And that, and in your life, and I mean, Casa Marcela, I mean, you talk about in your story, just the idea of buying this house and,
yes.
and trying to create an experience that's similar. This
yes.
idea of being able to imagine what this be more than a home. This could be a place to entertain. This could be, in your case, a place to do a lot of your work that you do for television and
yes.
other places, a place to have fresh food. I mean, the
yes.
garden in the back. So talk about those experiences that you learned from your family, your father and your mother, and how they translate to modern day what you do right now with your family.
100%. Before I had this house, I was always in little apartments. It was just me and my son, Fowl. We barely made up a person between the both of us. We were so tiny. So I never needed a large space, honestly. But there was always this part of me that wanted to entertain the way that my family entertained when I was growing up. And I was looking for a home. I wanted that stability for my son. I wanted him to have memories of one home growing up like I did. And we'd moved like 8 times in the past like 3 years from before I bought the house. And I walked into this house, and it was huge for me and him. It was completely unnecessary. It just was unnecessary. But I just remember thinking, like, everything I've ever dreamed of, the garden, my family, the shooting here, the kitchen, the everything. And I was just like, I just have to make this happen. And it was all just based on that necessity to be able to share it with my family.
Mm-hmm.
And this book is a reflection of that, of the recipes that I serve them. I talk about my crew and how they're at the house all the time, and we're shooting recipes, we're testing recipes for the kitchen, we're testing recipes for the Today Show, we're testing, everything is happening there. And you know, when people are like, oh, you're so lucky, you get to, you know, work at home and be close to your kids. And I'm like, it's not luck. It's been planned that
right.
way since
right.
I was like 18 years old. I've been saying, like, I need to be in a place where I can do all my stuff that I love, which is cooking and family and entertaining. And I got to find a way to make money off of that.
right.
And it happened. So, and that's the book. So it's working out. It's working out.
Chef Marcela Valladolid is the co-host of The Kitchen.
Yes.
She's also, it's amazing. The book is called Casa Marcela, Recipes and Food Stories of My Life in the Californias. It's out now. She's in town in Chicago for a sold out event. She's doing a demo
yes.
tomorrow night.
Yes.
But, you know, I'm fascinated because, like you just mentioned, this idea of planning. Your career, when you get out, you know, you started getting into food and you studied French, you were able to get into the world of journalism, you did some editing, some
yes.
recipe stylist,
yes.
which I don't know much about, but
yes.
into the world of television and the Food Network. I mean, there has been a trajectory that you know, it takes time and it takes patience to get through. Talk about your career. I mean, is this where, when you talk about being 18 years old, is this where you saw yourself being in a spot where you're on the Food Network and you're also a chef and you're being able to present your vision of food?
I'm not going to lie. I saw it. I dreamt about it, you know? I'm not going to lie and be like, oh, I never imagined this ever happening. I've been, like, dreaming about it my whole life. So there was definitely some visualization happening, for sure. But I think I was lucky because really early on, I saw a space that needed to be filled in terms of Mexican cuisine. Not the traditional, very labor-intensive by the wonderful folks like Diana Kennedy and Rick Bayless and Susana Palazuelos, like the big, big, big Mexican writers. I knew that there needed to be space for someone who was actually like me, bicultural, that had very deep roots in Mexican food and tradition, but also lived on the U.S. side of the border and wanted to be able to make these recipes, but with the ingredients that you can find on the U.S. side of the border. Exactly. Make it accessible. And I, from when I was 17 or 18 years old, I saw that void. So I just, that was just the goal. That was just the goal. And I mentioned this, I just did a blog entry on my computer on the plane. And I remember growing up that whole time in Tijuana and seeing the misconceptions and that whole time thinking, you guys have no idea. The food is so amazing. The culture is so amazing. The cities are so amazing. The colonial architecture. I mean, it's all based on this huge pride that I have from the country that I grew up in that I feel is sometimes not portrayed in its true light. And I felt there was that void for somebody to talk about.
I mean,
that.
You've talked a lot about the idea of authentic.
Yes.
And the concept, I mean, because there's a great piece, I forgot, it was either in the book or read about it, just the idea that, you know, with chefs at different places, you know, people have from Tijuana or other or down in that area have been very clear to say you're doing it wrong. You're not wrapping a tamale the right way. You're not. You're doing it the wrong way.
Yes.
You and your career, you've had such a tremendous ability to almost be to fuse these things together, your French background, to take the authentic cooking that your parents taught you. How do you see yourself when it comes to authentic? Because there's a lot of stuff in here that is, yes, it takes the flavors of Tijuana, but you can feel your experience, yes. What you bring to it.
Yes.
So how do you do that?
Yeah. But you just said it. What is not authentic if it's authentic to you? You know what I'm saying? Like, what is not authentic if it's authentic to me? I grew up in Tijuana. And in Tijuana, we have a huge transient community. All of Mexico comes to Tijuana looking for opportunities, either in Tijuana or to cross the border into San Diego, and they don't make it and they stay in Tijuana. So we have people from all over the country, and that influences our cuisine hugely. And we have a lot of traditions that trickle down from the U.S. in the 60s and 70s. Like Jell-O is huge in Mexico. Like it made its way down in the 50s and 60s, and it's still there. And at every baby shower in all of Mexico, there's a gazillion Jell-O molds, all different colors. Like we're influenced by like people in southern Mexico make fun of us and say, oh, the people in Tijuana, they're basically Americans. And you know what I'm saying? Like we have our own identity. But in Tijuana, it's such a peculiar situation because the fact that we're not an old, old city, we're, you know, 120 years old or something like that. And as opposed to the pre-Hispanic, you know, cities that have been around
since Aztecs
and are still creating those actual recipes. We have more of are permitted more to play with our food. And I also mentioned that in the book. In central Mexico, you go down there and there's only one way to do things. There's only one way to make tamales in Yucatan and one way to make cochinita pibil. And there's one way to do things. And if you don't make it the way Jose's grandmother made it, you are dead wrong and it's blasphemy and
I get it all the time.
Yes, it's very intense and I get it all the time. And I think the solution to it is to be very straightforward.
But you do get it all the time? I mean, people are calling you out for
oh gosh, yes.
Really?
Yeah, I get it on my social all the time. People actually, I'm really lucky because I get very little hate on social media. People are very decent and very kind. I think maybe it's because I show my family so much. Maybe they think my kids are reading or something. I don't know. But I definitely get a lot of, why do you add eggs to churros, for example? Because I like the texture of a pot of choux better than the traditional churro that's only flour and water. But I get it all the time. And my response is always, this is how my mom made it. And my mom was 175% Mexican. Like, yeah, it doesn't get more Mexican than that.
I guess,
you know?
I mean, as you, even as we started this thread, I mean, it was authentic to you. The concept of what you bring to this and what I know of your work and is that you are bringing the French-trained style that you learned to be a chef. You're blending it with what you learned growing up.
Yes.
And you're able to create authentic recipes with a little with I mean, I know it's a dirty word in food, fusion, but this concept that you're bringing two worlds together that don't necessarily go together, and it tastes great.
But at the end of the day, though, most of our desserts come from Europe anyway.
That's what I was going to ask. So learning is what you learn.
So flan ain't ours.
It's not yours.
Neither is churros.
Right.
We got all that from the Spaniards. So
do people have a hard time recognizing that? I mean, they think
it happens with a few different things. Like ceviche is also like a big deal because Peru is known to be the birthplace, but some people in Mexico want to claim it. Like it's just, but I just feel I'm never that intense. Maybe I should be, but I'm not that intense about cuisine, man. Yeah. I mean, honestly, in my heart, I'm like, if it tastes good, if it takes you back to a special place, and that's the biggest compliment that I get from people. I just did a huge signing in San Diego, and like I would get really emotional when people would be like, you just took me back to when I was a kid in San Miguel and you made it so easy because I can make it the way my mom made it and I found all the ingredients at the supermarket and it's just and that's all it is. And that's all I care about. The authenticity, it's a great word. People want to stamp everything they do with that word. Good for them. I just want it to be good and authentic to me.
For you, and this will wrap up here, but I love the fact that what you do on The Kitchen and other play, and even in the book, I mean, the amazing photography in here.
Thank you.
You talked about the In Casa Marcela, just the idea that you could do shooting, and you could shoot, and you could do photography, and you could do all sorts of stuff, and it's really represented in here. How important is the visual to the food? How important? Stopped?
I'm very passionate about the visual.
Yeah, I mean that's that. How important is it? I mean, in this day and age, when people are going to try different recipes, and I mean, they're almost at this day. I mean, think about this, just looking up on your phone or in the book.
Yes.
If there's not a picture to go with it, I'm not doing it.
Before I was a chef, I studied architecture. And before I studied architecture, I wanted to be an interior designer, but my dad didn't let me. He said I needed a more professional career, so that's why I ended up in architecture. So I actually think about food backwards. I think first about how it's going to look and then about how it's going to taste, which is probably not very chef-like. But when I'm thinking about that jalapeno roast chicken that I told you that you have to go home and make this evening, even if it's 11 p.m., I'm thinking about how I'm going to set the table. And I'm thinking that the chicken's kind of brown with a little green, so we're going to need some purple, so I add purple potatoes. You know what I'm saying? For me, it's a very, very visual experience. Cooking for me, it's the whole thing. I want the plate, not just the food. I want the plate. I want the whole thing, the whole setting to just be really beautiful because I'm with you 100%. When it comes to and that book, by the way, was 100% shot in my house with my props, everything. I was like, it's just going to be the real deal, how we function here. You're going to see some repeats because I don't have 75 different sets of plates. We're normal here. We have a couple different ones, and that's all we have. But, yeah, it's the visual is very important for me, and I'll tell you why even more so because I think part of that misconception – I mean, what do you think about when you think of a plate of Mexican food? Honestly.
I mean, rice and beans, right? I mean,
exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. And for me, I just needed to be able to present it in a way that perhaps you'd never seen it before, in a way that would get you excited about presenting it for a beautiful family meal or for a beautiful event or for your Mother's Day, not just for like Cinco de Mayo with like margaritas and like tortilla chips and salsa. Like I wanted you to be able to envision it as a part of your beautiful life.
Yeah.
You know?
It's interesting, too, to think about it that way of how it's going to look before how it's going to taste.
Yeah, that's big.
I love it. Chef Marcela Valladolid is in studio. She is the co-host of The Kitchen, among other shows on Food Network. The book is called Casa Marcela, Recipes and Food Stories of My Life in the California. She's in town. She's got an event that's sold out tomorrow night. Chef Marcela, thanks so much for joining us tonight. We really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Great to have Chef Marcela in studio. How cool is that? Foods, I have to say, I mean, there's probably a lot of listeners out there who watch The Kitchen on Food Network. I fell in love with it, mostly because of its picnic set. It's very, they have the indoor kitchen, but then when they want to get a little bit frisky and they want to go outside, they have the picnic set.
Very nice.
Yeah. And Jeff Morrow, who I realize we haven't had on the show, is one of the co-hosts as well. And he's got the sandwich shop over in Wicker Park. Great to have him on as well. But great to have her on to talk about that area of food. Very interesting, too, the idea of, as a chef, she's more interested in what it looks like than what it tastes.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's awesome. And I never think about that. You know, as a burgeoning chef myself, mostly with the crock pot. Yeah. I don't care what it looks like. I have to win one of the battles.
Yeah.
Right? You have to, as a chef who has really doesn't have any training whatsoever. Mm-hmm. I need to, it needs to taste right or look right. I'm not going to get both. And so for me, I think I'm going to have a better shot at it tasting right than looking right. And it's so true. I mean, I think about, you know, my wife as well. Like, she's really into how it looks. But, I mean, down to the idea of what you know, purple potatoes and what plate you put out that matches the food.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's above my pay grade.
I mean, I think at home, I think the most important thing is if it tastes good. Because, you know, really anywhere, I guess. But, I mean, if you want, you know, I don't really care what it looks like at home. Right. If I'm going to a restaurant, I'm like, oh, I do want it to look nice as well as taste good. But at home, it's like, I'm shoveling it in as
fast
as I can.
But I feel like maybe as I look for ways to improve my life, mm-hmm. you know, as we all get older and we're like, what's the meaning? This could be an area that if I took more pride
mm-hmm.
in plating my food, you know, even by myself, like a lunch, I made it look nice. If that would have an effect on my daily life, if I'd be like, oh, you know, my outlook, I'm happier.
It might make you feel better.
Yeah, it might make you feel better, right? Something to think about. Or would I be more like, I don't really care. Just put it all on the plate. The jump is on. They're going to talk about who's going where in free agency. Just put a bunch of chips on a plate. That's so true.
Yeah, the ease I can open my plastic container. That's what I'm really focused on.
Right.
If it's too little or too hard to open, that's what I'm worried about.
But I mean, there's something about this concept of buying our homes or renting our homes and wanting to choose a place where we live for something else. Meaning, you know, when she was talking about, like, even in the book, she talks about being able to see the place, realizing it's too big. It's too expensive, everything she went through, you know, before she was even on Food Network. But having an image in her head about what this could be, and in the back, this could be a garden, or this could be where we, you know, entertain, this could be where I host family dinners. I mean, that's relatable to everybody, right?
Yeah.
I mean, you go in and you kind of think about your space and what you want to do in that space. I mean, I think of our office, Pete, and I think the first week we were in there, we're like, man, we're going to change it up. We're going to make this cushions.
Yeah.
On this little mm-hmm. wall area, mm-hmm. we're going to put this chair over here. We have done nothing. Like, it is still looks like we moved in a week ago.
Yeah. It has a very college dorm feel to it.
Yeah. Although you did find a machine that you plugged in, and I think it blows cool air. I'm not sure. But we found out the hard way last week when the heat wave came through, that I think the Trib Tower, to be able to make it comfortable for the guests in the studio in the front on Michigan Avenue means
kind of shut it down for the back.
Forget about you guys in the back.
Yeah.
Because there was a couple days last week when it was hot. I'm like, are you serious? This is what we're doing? This is how we're... So you found a little holdover. I think it was a holdover from Gary Meyer.
Oh, yeah. Was it?
Well, yeah. I mean, it was his office, right? That's where we're at. So I think we
added something.
Yeah, so we were able to turn the fan on, whatever that thing was, and it seems to be working.
Let's do one of those. Is there a sponsor, you know, like with Lou Manfredini? Can we get like a makeover of our office?
Yeah, right. We can't get on Best Office.
Yeah.
I can't get the Property Brothers to come in right before
right,
we
exactly,
leave here.
Yeah.
Oh, that would be great. How great of a bit would that be if you can get the Property Brothers to do something to your little office in the back, like your cubicle? See, I wish I worked for HGTV. I'd be killing it over there. We should do it where we go and we'll take a break here. We'll come back. We'll get the news and Esmeralda in traffic coming up here. Stay with us. You know, at the top of the show, Esmeralda, I will say news, weather, and traffic with Rob Martier and Esmeralda Leon, production by Pete Zimmerman. And tonight, for inexplicable reason, I left your name out of it, right?
How dare you?
How dare I? And I knew it right away. I was like, wow, I missed it. Ah, darn it. And there were texters that text in. They were like, you skipped Esmeralda. Where's Esmeralda? 3 hours before your shift.
Oh, my goodness.
Right? That's pretty impressive.
Tell them I'm
impressive.
At home.
That's loyalty.
It is. Wow.
They want to know what
they're... I
feel
honored.
Yeah, right? That's good. They're looking out for you.
I'm going to put a cardboard cutout up here of me when I'm not here.
Right. That'll work.
I'll just be in the corner, just peeking through.
You could check in once in a while just to blow their mind. You have the cardboard cutout, and then your face pops in the corner of the room. So it's like a horror movie. We're in two different places.
Meanwhile, when you miss Pete and my name.
Eh. Yeah. No, it doesn't matter. Eh. If I don't say Martier, no, yeah, they're like, nah. I called Bob Kessler and David Jennings last week, Rob Martier, like four times.
I'm sure they appreciate it.
Yeah,
that.
They loved it. They loved it. They told me afterwards how much they loved it. Thanks, Rob. It's a download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, now it's time for Studio 435, our weekly showcase of the best live music that Chicago has to offer right here in our Allstate Showcase studio on beautiful Michigan Avenue. Tonight, we have a return guest, the Chicago power pop band Mooner, was one of the first bands to play with us back in late 2015. They were in studio promoting their debut album, Masterpiece. Mooner just put out a new record with Kit Shields called EML 101, Volume 1, back in March. The band consists of singer-songwriter Lee Ketch, as well as Andy Ketch, Joe Pruitt, Steve Slagg, and Nick Harris. And new music is on the way. We're going to hear some of it tonight, but you'll also hear more of it this weekend as Mooner plays at the Hideout Saturday the 24th at 1354 West Wabanzia. Lee Ketch is in studio tonight, and he's brought us his new music, but he's also brought his guitar. So let's start off Studio 435 tonight with the song Masterpiece. Take it away, Lee.
Shake off the spells that are gathered by him from the time that I didn't have you. What did I say when you told me you knew and that I should not be worried? Think of your life with someone like me and tell me it isn't right. All our friends agree that something was going down. It's my masterpiece, this love that you gave to me. It's my masterpiece, this love that you gave. Don't take it away from me. What did you say when I asked you to be mine until we both are buried? What you had in mind, you thought of us getting married. All our friends agree that something was going down. It's my masterpiece, this love that you gave to me. It's my masterpiece, this love you gave, don't take it away. It's my masterpiece, oh Lord. Don't take it away, don't let it stray. Don't take it away, I don't know my name. Don't take it away, don't take it away from me. Thank you.
Yeah, there we go. That's one of my favorites right there. Lee Ketch and the band Mooner. Lee Ketch is here tonight with his acoustic guitar. Come on down. We'll take a seat here. The band Mooner, which is Andy Ketch, Joe Pruitt, Steve Slag, Nick Harris, and Lee Ketch. They have new music on the way. Their latest, which was in March, was EML 101 Volume 1 by Kit Shields and Mooner, which is a collection of covers.
Yeah.
Great to see you. Thanks for coming back, Lee. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Justin.
That sounds great, man. It was fun, like, going back down memory lane, you know, going back through the band again. You know, it's interesting, too, because you're the singer-songwriter. You do a lot of the work for the band. Mm-hmm. And there are times that you play, it's almost Lee Ketch from Mooner. You know, it's almost like you're solo. Talk about that. Talk about the idea of the band being Mooner and you being Mooner and being able to play both ways like that.
Oh, sure, yeah. I mean, I guess it's just a matter of, the band's technically been around since, like, 2009, and I think I'm the only surviving member at this point. So it's, I write a lot of the songs or all the songs for the records. So it's easy to just go out as myself. I like a moniker. I like a band name. It just makes you feel a little more secure. So,
well, I mean, even in the, the stuff that you do with Kit Shields and Mooner, the EML 101, the stuff you put out in March, I mean, the covers, I mean, you look at the track listings, and it's Lee Ketch on, Lee Ketch on guitar, Lee Ketch on lyrics, Lee Ketch on production. I mean, you are doing all the work on this stuff.
Yeah, especially on the covers album, my wife and I, Kit, recorded the whole thing in our apartment in our practice space.
Really?
And we played almost all the instruments, but like guys from the band also dropped in. Andy, the drummer, played. My brother as well played on a lot of the tracks, and like even old members from the band came in and played. And so it was fun. It was like we had a lot of discussions about how to title it, and it just seemed like, you know, it's all the guys and then Kit as well doing all the, like the production and the song choice and the singing and the playing. And so it was like a big kind of family friend band. Yeah.
It definitely feels that way. It's good. Some great stuff on that. All right, here's what we'll do. We'll take a quick break. Lee Ketch from Mooner in studio. He's going to be at Hideout on Saturday. Are you playing with, is that the full band or is that just you?
That's going to be the full band.
Full band, yeah. Saturday night at the Hideout. All right, we'll take a break. Studio 435. Stay with us. Lee Ketch is in studio here. He is the man behind Mooner, the band, Chicago power pop band that can be seen at the Hideout this weekend. They were one of the first bands we had in studio. And we were just talking. I think we even predate Studio 435. It's like, I think you were one of the bands you guys came in and were like, we should do this all the time. we should give it a name.
That's awesome.
So I think you're even, you're sort of the incubators, which is good.
That's awesome.
You guys are going to be at the Hideout on Saturday night.
Yep.
Let's talk about, I mean, it's great to have you back because the last time you were in, I remember this, the record just came out. Yep. Masterpiece just came out.
Yeah.
You were talking about the record and putting it together. So talk about the new stuff and how you've evolved as a singer-songwriter. So take us from that point to now. I mean, you did the covers album with your wife. But, I mean, talk about how this music that you're working on now is different from the music you put together, a masterpiece.
Yeah. You know, like between the release of that record and now, there's been like 100% turnover in the band, except for myself. So like a bunch of new characters coming in and inspiring different kind of sounds and recordings is kind of just a fresh take on a lot of the new songs I've been writing. I wrote most of them in like a long weekend, and then we went into the studio and played a lot of it live. So, and we have it all recorded the next record, and we're just kind of waiting to see what we can do with it. But I think it was like very freeing. You just kind of, you get out of old habits and out of old ruts, and you have people bring in different kinds of ideas. And
for you as a writer, you're the kind of guy who sets a weekend and says, this is when I'm going to write an album. Are you the kind of guy that says, okay, I'm inspired, so get out of my way. Don't bother me. I got to shut the door. This is going to be my weekend. How do you approach the craft of songwriting?
Oh yeah. I tend to like write and record at the same time. Not as much recently, but I started out that way. I would like learn how to record using my camcorder, and I would like piece together tracks and like put them together in video editing software. And I never like learned how to play the guitar and write a song just kind of sitting there. So I think actually the last 10 years or so has been like trying to strip it back and trying to just do, make a song work on a guitar. And I would say that our next record is going to be a little more like that. I tend to kind of go both ways. I like to sometimes just, you get inspired and you just have to go do it and you have to capture it at that moment. But, you know, I work full time job and I have other bands and lots of stuff going on. So it's, sometimes you have to chip away at it. It's not as fun, but, you can get some great stuff.
For you as a musician and someone who dedicates to craft and at the same time you have to balance life and have a full time job, how do you find the fun? And I know it sounds so cheesy, but the concept of I would assume after working a long day and having other bands and things going on in your personal life that you're like, you know, I just want to drink a beer and watch TV. I don't want to have to make music. Or is music the kind of thing that just is the passion that drives you to do the other things?
I mean, I watch a lot of TV, but it definitely, I think variety has been pretty key for me for the last couple of years. And so we have like the covers record that took a few months just of dedication to knock that out over just weekends and nights. And working on a couple of the other bands. Joe is in Son of Rams. Nick has a band called Ricky Mirage. My brother Andy does music under his own. And the three of us have another band called The Obliques. And Steve has his project Youngest Son, and we just finished recording his record. So jumping around to lots of different projects, it seems pretty natural.
So do you guys all work on each other's projects? Like if it's
actually, I think we've almost all of us have played on each other's records, and everybody in the band's a songwriter. And actually on Saturday, we're going to start playing some of the other guys' songs because they just like fit so well now that we've all been working on it together. Right. It just kind of melds into this one thing.
Is that something that's new for you? I mean, as the sort of primary singer-songwriter for Mooner and the other iterations, to be in a position where you let the other people take the lead?
Yeah, it's awesome, though. I mean, it's at this point, it's like everybody plays on each other's stuff so much that it's kind of just like this one super band that can do a lot of different artists' music at once. So it's like, why not?
Why not?
Bring that out there on Saturday, you know?
You know, when you do the covers album, and you do it with your wife, is that an indication of songs that inspire you? Is it is it an indication of songs that just you've always wanted to play? When you're approaching a cover album, how do you choose the stuff you're going to use?
Well, it was great. Kit had a playlist in iTunes of like all these songs that Mooner should do at some point, and we just started going through them. It was a really spontaneous thing where we just started on Xanadu by Jeff Lynne. And we just kept recording until we had, I don't know, 20 songs or so, and trimmed it down and put it out. And it was kind of just like, you know, if we listen to a lot of Hall & Oates that week, that's what we're going to go record. We're going to go do a couple Hall & Oates songs. If you listen to a lot of Crowded House, we're going to go do that. So it was like very spontaneous, as opposed to Mooner, which can tend to be like very process driven. And you try and like make sure everything's ducks are in a row before you go record, and this was just like, you know, in your apartment. Just
Lee Ketch from Mooner in studio. Let's hear some more. You want to hear some more music? What do you want to play here?
I'm going to play a song that is unreleased called Desire.
Ooh, some new stuff. All right, Lee Ketch from Mooner in studio. They are playing on Saturday at the Hideout. Lee is a singer-songwriter, but also in the band Andy Ketch, Joe Pruitt, Steve Slag, and Nick Harris. They have a brand new slate of music that's out, that's been recorded. Their last album, EML 101 Volume 1, the collection of covers, was released with Kit Shields in March. But a couple of months. I feel like that was yesterday, but it's now been 3 months. All right, Lee, here is Lee. Take it away, Lee.
I try to tell you it's over now, but you don't understand that when I leave, I come back somehow. You're always right there in my hand. Desire, desire, desire. They told me that you're no good for me before I turned 13. Oh, but you're my baby, you're my girl. Take me with you in to my screen. Desire, desire, desire. A world of joy awaits on the other side. I can take you with me when I feel oh so sad. I thought reality was good enough for me. I want her to know that I try, yeah, try. Desire, desire, desire.
Lee Ketch from the band Mooner in studio. He brought his guitar tonight. They're going to be playing at the Hideout coming up here on Saturday night. Lee Ketch, singer-songwriter, as well as Andy Ketch, Joe Pruitt, Steve Slag, and Nick Harris, the other members of the band. Let's take a quick break, and we will get tonight's news, and we'll come back and do some more live music with Lee. But right now, let's get an update on tonight's news in just a second here. You know, it's interesting. Before we go there, do you guys have an idea of when this kind of music will come out? I mean, is this like the do you, when you say wait to see how things play out,
oh,
do you sort of have a plan? Do you say,
no.
Okay.
I was just Kit and I were sitting in the living room yesterday talking about it. So it's in the works.
It's in the works.
And that's about as much news as I have for you. I'm sorry. I come on national Chicago radio and say I got nothing.
You got nothing. No, but we get to hear the music here. You know, so it's almost like an exclusive, right?
Uh-huh.
There you go, little exclusive. All right, well, we'll do more music with Lee Ketch from the band Mooner. Mooner playing at the Hideout coming up here on the 24th. They've got new music. We heard some of it, but that's the extent of which we will talk about the new stuff. Thanks, Rob. It's a download, 720 WGN at Studio 435, where we play the best live music Chicago has to offer in our Allstate Showcase studio in our Michigan Avenue, beautiful Michigan Avenue studios. People outside right now on this nice night. In studio, Lee Ketch. He's a singer-songwriter with the band Mooner. The band Mooner's Lee, Andy Ketch, Joe Pruitt, Steve Slag, and Nick Harris. Lee is here. You know, and this weekend, on Saturday, they will be back on stage at the Hideout. That's Saturday the 24th, the Hideout, 1354 West Wabanzia. Lee's got his guitar. Let's hear another track. Lee, what do you want to play here?
I'm going to play another new one, The Stand-In.
The Stand-In. Here's Lee Ketch from Mooner.
Doesn't rebuke, always churning the screw. He comes home and he finds something new to say it won't do. Sits and waits for the truth. Don't mind him, he's the stand-in, okay. Don't mind him, he's the stand-in, okay. Don't mind him, he's the stand-in, okay. In every single way, he comes in and he's looking at you. He cries and he moans about losing his youth. His bones turn into dust and his nails to rust. Guess it all was a bust. Don't mind him, he's the stand-in, okay. Don't mind him, he's the stand-in, okay. Don't mind
Catch from the band Mooner in studio. He is a part of the band that will be playing at the Hideout this Saturday night, the 24th, 1354 West Wabansia. The others in the band, Andy Ketch, Joe Pruitt, Steve Slag, and Nick Harris will be there. They're working on new music. That was a track, another exclusive here on the download. Lee and the band were here. Jeez, man, I can't believe it's been a year and a half now. But,
me neither.
You know, thinking about that, I mean, it's fascinating to me as someone who doesn't necessarily know bands and how the music, and I don't want to say industry, but the music scene works, that there has been complete turnover.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and I'm like this idea that you and you know, as a singer-songwriter in the city of Chicago, people are going to leave. I mean, there's going to be a bass player that might leave and a drummer that might leave, and you might move around. I mean, talk about you talked a little bit about the positives of that, of being given more inspiration to work with other people. But what are also some of the challenges of working in this scene in Chicago where a lot of musicians are going to move on?
Oh, yeah. It's pretty natural. It's like always sad when it happens because everybody works so hard, and then it's kind of like that phase is over and you just move on to the next thing. I don't know. I decided to have a 5-piece band, so getting around to like shows out of town and stuff, it requires way too much work than just like hopping in a sedan or something like that. I don't know. It's, to be honest, it's like, I try to just like keep writing the songs, and it's sort of like when they're done, it's kind of like, all right, who wants to come along and do this? And then we go and do it. And then people move on if they have other projects they want to work on. But, and it's like some of the guys that left, I've still play in bands with them, and it's just, it's never personal.
It's interesting because it's different than what you would think of the stereotypical, journey of a band. The idea that's 4 guys or 5 guys and you're all together and that the bass player leaves is a big deal. I mean, the concept in which you work around the music that you produce, you write, you perform, you sing, and you write, this idea that there are floating pieces that people can come in and come out, that's not usually how it is. So talk about how you foster that kind of environment.
Oh, sure. I think it pretty much started at the beginning. In 2009, it was my little brother Andy was like a teenager still, and my little brother David played guitar, and then our like childhood friend or high school friend David played bass. And it's kind of like I came home for a summer. We were all home from school. And so that was just the band for 3 months. And then I went to school, back to school. And then it was like my roommates, and that was the band for 6 months. And I was pretty much trained to do that from the beginning, you know? So it feels natural to me at this point. And I've definitely just given in that's probably how it'll be, just because I know so many talented people, and it's not like I'm paying them anything. I can't just keep them around on retainer who's waiting for when inspiration strikes or whatever.
Do you miss any of the, I don't know if this is the right word, but loyalty in the way that the people are like, I'm really into Mooner's music and I want to play bass on this and I bought it. I bought a piece of this. Do you lose a little bit of that of sort of being able to sort of just float around and be like, let's grab a cake, you can play on this track?
Oh, yeah. I don't know. Buying a piece of Mooner would be buying just like a vacant lot somewhere. in an industrial area that has someone squatting.
Hey, with
on
the
it.
Real estate market, you never know, right?
You know what? Actually, you've changed my mind. That's a pretty valuable piece right there. But I think I kind of struggled with that, where it was like, this is the dream for a couple of years, and where it was, I think I really, for some of the like iterations of the band, I was like, this has to be like a brotherhood or something. I love rock and roll myth so much. I love that like U2 has been the same band for that many years. I definitely have like dreams of that. That would be awesome. But I don't think I've ever worked that way, and neither have the guys that I...
And most of the musicians that you come across, right? Well, I mean, in Chicago, and it is apparent, I mean, you think of music towns, and think of, you know, a New York City, but I think of a Nashville as a place where musicians go to make careers. Is Chicago like that? Sure. I mean, is Chicago has more music per capita than a place like Nashville, and it seems to have more going for it in a lot of different arts and, you know, artistic endeavors than some of the bigger cities on the coast. Is Chicago's music scene like that? I mean, do people come here to Chicago to play music to make it a career?
Probably. I did come here for the music. I grew up here, and coming here into the city, it really did happen that it's just like I met so many musicians right away, starting with Craigslist and then just going from there. I don't personally know very many people who are doing it as a career, like full time. Most people are my situation where it's work and then you do this as much as possible, right, as your family and money will allow. But yeah, I know a couple of people who do, and they haven't moved away yet. So like one guy plays in a covers band and it's awesome. He goes all over the Midwest. One guy is, you know, out there doing it professionally, touring all the time. But a lot of the guys are just, you know, they just really like it here, and we're taking advantage of the moment, you know, that we're all here at the same time and until we start scattering again.
Well, I ask you because you're closer to it than I am, but I mean, how does one make a living in music? I mean, how do you, if you said, okay, tomorrow I'm going to get rid of that day job. You know what? I'm going to make an effort to only play music. That's going to be my job. How does a musician do that? Is it just gig until, and just try to piece whatever you can, or do you have to find some sort of organized job?
Yeah. I have no idea. I don't know. It is my job. I definitely treat it like my job. I feel like it's the thing that I do. But in terms of it making money, I don't really have any problems with somebody trying to make money from it. I don't really have any interest in the business side or figuring out how to squeeze cash out of it. You know, I love show business, but I don't really have a knack for it, so I just don't have an interest and don't pursue it at all. But I know a lot of people who, I think now is like an amazing time if you are a little more entrepreneurial, where you can just take charge of your career and you completely drive it and you're the boss and the songwriter and the social media activist and all that stuff.
Yeah, you don't
and
need a major label per se.
I don't think so. We never like pursued that, you know, and all the labels we've worked with have been one or two people that are just fans, and we work out a deal that we can put out the music and then we go on to the next thing. It's not that anybody, I've never really met anybody who's cynical about it. It's just kind of they just take the means that they have and that's the career, quote unquote, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's, you know, I'm not a musician, so I don't have the basic understanding of you know, what it takes to live that life, to do the kind of, to play every weekend and do that kind of stuff and have it be your passion where your day job is not. But I'm familiar with comedy and other things and how that kind of works. But there was always a blueprint or a strategy, you know, if I could get my work to this person, if I could get my work in front of an audience, if I could get my work in front of Hollywood, you know, and get an agent and get paid to write, there was always like sort of ladders you could climb.
Yeah.
Now, I'm not saying we ever did, but you know, they're always, is it the same in music? I mean, are the ladders, if you sat down with your wife or whatever and said, all right, you know, we want to make this record and this is what we want to do. I mean, could you start to carve out or more of a strategy to make it a living? Or is that just not available to musicians at this point?
I don't know. I don't, from what I understand from like the major label days, it was not exactly, there were pretty clear benchmarks. It seemed like it was not always skewed towards the artist in terms of their fulfillment as a creative person. Like business is just, sometimes it rubs up against creativity and then that's a, people leave kind of unsatisfied, but I don't know. I don't really think that there's as clear delineations in terms of like what you can go and do. I think a lot of people that I know who are doing it, it's completely different. Every single artist who is like, I'm really gonna rely on this. Like one guy opened a studio, one guy really does just tour with big headlining bands and it totally works. And it's, I don't necessarily think that there's as much of like the A&R guy from from Capitol is gonna like be there at the gig and we gotta make sure it's perfect.
Right.
It just really seems
doesn't
like
doesn't work that way, huh?
I don't think so. I'm sure there that exists out there, but I haven't personally like seen it at all. It's all been totally self-started from the musicians themselves.
But and that seems, and I guess, you know, you speaking for your community and the musicians that you play with, and Mooner is a band that every time, you know, you've been here before and on again, it's not like, you know, you're playing in, you know, we're just playing in my garage trying to make things happen. I mean, you have success in the way and the musicians that you play with. What, I mean, there is a contentment. I mean, do you feel fulfilled as musicians as you create new music and you're going to put out a new album that you don't necessarily need to email the A&R guy and make sure he's at the place?
Well, because I spent like 20, you know, from probably right around before the debut record, I spent a lot of time. I have a lot of spreadsheets to prove that it was like I tried to sort of just calculate all this stuff a little bit. And I would talk with other musicians and they would share resources. And that was like so unfulfilling because it's not that it didn't reap any rewards, because it totally did. But in terms of like fulfillment as a person, making the record, even just finishing it, and my wife rolls her eyes at this all the time, but it's like, maybe I won't put it out. Maybe I finished it and I'm just, I'm pretty happy in terms of all the like, stuff that comes around, making sure people hear it and touring and all of that. I sort of dread it at this point, but
it's the actual art that you like.
And even less than the recording, it's like the moment you write it, and then you can't really beat that. Some people, it's like getting on stage and you can't beat that. For me, it's like I finish a song and that's pretty much the perfect state of creative like zen, and then it's like all downhill from there, because then you hear it back in the speakers and it's you thought it was awesome, but maybe it's not so great.
Lee Ketch is the singer-songwriter with the band Mooner. His band, Andy Ketch, Joe Pruitt, Steve Slack, and Nick Harris, also in the band. They're playing Hideout on Saturday the 24th. Lee's in studio tonight, a return engagement for Mooner. Let's do this. Let's take a break. We'll come back and we'll get one last live song from Lee Ketch. Stay with us. It's Download 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. We're Studio 435 wrapping up tonight. Live music in studio. Lee Ketch from the band Mooner. The band is Lee, Andy Ketch, Joe Pruitt, Steve Slag, and Nick Harris. And they will be on stage at the Hideout this Saturday night, the 24th. They got new music on the way soon. Maybe it never puts it out. That's possible. All right. We've got one more track here in Studio 435. Here is an old one. This one's called Alice and Lee Ketch, Studio 435. Take it away.
Shimmering praise, your red hair blown back from your face. Why can't you share some of that holy grace? Addison, 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 Addison. Divine. your piety mine. Oh Lord Jesus, send me a sign. Addison, 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 Addison.
Lee Ketch from the band Mooner in studio tonight. They are going to be at the Hideout this Saturday, 1354 West Wabansia. The band, of course, Lee Ketch, Andy Ketch, Joe Pruitt, Steve Slag, and Nick Harris. Mooner, of course, they came in here to start off what was Studio 435 a year and a half ago when they came in to promote their album Masterpiece. Back tonight. Lee, thanks so much for coming in and playing. Good luck with the show and good luck with the new album, and we'd love to have you back.
Thanks, Justin. I appreciate it.
That's going to do it tonight for The Download. Patty Vasquez coming up next. She's here.
Oh, my gosh. I know. Isn't it weird?
So weird.
I know. I love that we do Music Monday together and Bob Ferguson rocking that.
Bob was great tonight, yeah.
It makes everyone sound as good on the air as they do in studio.
I had a funny story earlier. It was funny because Mooner was on our show before, and I was looking through the stuff, and I remember I was like, oh, I know this band. And then they said, it said, you know, oh, check us out on WGN from like a year ago. And I was like, oh, they must have been on Patty. And I press play, and there's me going, here they are, Mooner. And I'm like, I'm losing my mind.
No.
I'm losing my mind.
Look, here's the thing. Is it's not that it runs together. Is that we dedicate so much focus to every single show.
Gotta move to the next one. Yeah.
Yeah, you want to make sure that every show gets its attention in the moment.
Right.
So don't beat yourself up.
You and I are both on the WGNRadio.com right now in
our kilts.
In our kilts.
You were given a kilt to wear.
Yeah.
I brought my own utility kilt.
Yeah.
I had a.
You always have a utility kilt.
I do.
Right?
I have several utility kilts from the Irish American Heritage Center.
Oh, there you go.
Which are available at every Irish Fest every summer. By
okay,
the way,
there you go.
Up. So you can get your own. My boys all have kilts,
and
they wear them in public.
Yeah, I would. I had no problem. It was comfortable.
You look good.
Yeah. Well, thank you.
Took Pete a while to take his pants off. I had to convince him to pull his jeans off. I mean, it was for real. I was like, "Come on, take your pants off."
Yeah, he had the jeans underneath.
I apologize.
90-degree heat.
I apologize to your wife. But I mean, he had a kilt with jeans over them.
It was a good look. He was like the hipster. He was a Scottish hipster.
You know, I hadn't even thought of that. Yeah. I apologize for ruining that for you.
He was like ironic, like, I gotta wear this, but I'll keep my jeans on.
Work's making me do it. I think Rob Martier would have rocked that kilt.
Yeah, he would have.
I failed my travel plans with Esmeralda Leon. That was entirely on me, by the way.
Oh, no.
I will go ahead and say that I was given a task and I fell down on the job. So that was me.
Uh-oh.
Sorry, Esmeralda.
Well, I'm not
awkward.
Blaming you.
I'm taking you to Irish Fest. I'm not saying it's better than Scottish Festival. I'm just saying it's in my neighborhood. I know how to get there. I mean, that was some weird roads. I thought was like way out, and I didn't know Itasca was right there off of 90.
It was funny because I just put in the Google, you know, take me to the whatever the address was. But it was like heavy athletic field at the Scottish Festival. And so when I pulled into the Westin parking lot in Itasca, and then I'm like, this doesn't seem like a field. I looked at closer and it said the in the health club. Like it didn't say heavy athletic. It said athletic club. So I was at the Westin club. So that's why I was like 15, 20 minutes late.
Is Itasca like Rosemont, where Rosemont just has the gambling and sort of the periphery of O'Hare? Is Itasca just like a corporate, hey, we have a field here, do some stuff here?
Cause I don't think so.
I don't know.
I've never really been to a downtown Itasca. But
right? Well, let us
know. It was nice where it was. Yeah.
We will open up the phone lines during my show
there
for
Itasca.
We'll find out more about
what's
you.
On the show tonight.
We have music. We have, oh, thank you very much. We have Joe Renardo is on our show tonight. We also have, oh, Rich Linkov is joining us.
Cool.
He has some good legal news.
Yeah,
I'm guessing comedian Paul Farvar Esquire will want to jump in on that. Dr. Daphne Scott, Audrey Jonas. And I have a question for people that I want to ask about.
All right.
Mm-hmm.
All right.
Should law enforcement be consider how they present themselves on social media? Their beliefs, their attitudes. I mean, like, you know how, like, a lot of companies have this idea of, like, you know, this moral code, or kids who are in high school or teens, if you present yourself in a way that goes against that. But if law enforcement or if, like, any, like, civil servant, if you work for the city of Chicago or the state of Illinois, should you be held by standards, a moral code?
That's a great question. I mean, look, in the media, we're held by a moral code.
Yeah.
If Mark Giangreco was a good example, where he said something about the Trump and he got suspended, a sports guy. So, and we just saw that not in recent time. So I wonder if police officers, because they're civil servants, fall in the same category.
And firefighters. I saw a firefighter post something in the spring that I was like, oh, you're saving people's lives, and yet you are diminishing somebody because of their background.
I would assume, as I will tell my son, my 9-year-old son, everything is public and everything is on
there.
The record, man.
Yeah.
That's how it is.
All right. So that's what we're going to talk about.
All right.
A little
bit
later.
Have a great show.